Welcome to Ladies with Gumption, episode 63, Trading Places. I am May, and I am here with
Tatiana
and Jessica.
We recap DC TV in a flash, as you know. You can find us on Tumblr at ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. You can listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes, and if you're feeling friendly, you can leave us a nice review. You can also find us on Google Play. You can send us any thoughts or feedback on Twitter at DCTVGumption and or by email, ladieswgumption@gmail.com. To kick off, we're going to start with our Elseworlds So White. The hashtag
was not ours, but
right, not our hashtag, but it was a hashtag on Twitter.
Yes, and one we will be talking about.
Yes, which came out after realizing that Iris specifically wasn't getting to cross over to other episodes, but also speaks to the overall problem of these crossovers being, well, very white. And even all of the new characters they introduced this crossover, with the exception of Monitor, were white, and the rare characters of color who got to crossover, like Cisco and Diggle, weren't given very much to do in comparison. And on The Flash, Iris is leading lady, and it's glaringly obvious that she only got to crossover last year because she was marrying Barry. Otherwise, she's consistently relegated to her own show, while her other cast members, all of them, get to crossover. And Felicity, too, this season didn't get to crossover, and it was sexist. And in Candace's case, blatant misogynoir, given the oversight so many years in a row. And we'll talk more about the oversight throughout the episode, but what are you ladies' thoughts on the hashtag and about the exclusion of Iris specifically, as well as other characters?
My thoughts are that I just think that it's, like, at this point, it's been 4 years of crossovers, so you'd think that they would know how to balance the characters better, and they would have realized how it looks that every single one of their leads is white, mm-hmm. You know? And now that they excluded Sarah, every single one of their leads is straight. And, like, without Sarah and without Legends, they just, like, added Superman. So, it's just three white dudes, and then a white girl who didn't get to do as much as the white dudes. So, so I don't know. I just don't know why it doesn't seem like it goes in one ear and out the other. And just, like, even when they try to include people, like, obviously Cisco gets to cross over, and Diggle gets to cross over, but they only get, like, one or two scenes, and mostly they play support, right? So there's very much, like, a feeling of division, right? There's a segregation there of, like, the white heroes, and then, like, the support of color. Or someone tweeted me, and they're like, oh, did you mean the help? So.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, basically. Like, yeah. You have, like you said, there's your three white main leads. You add Batwoman, who is also white.
I forgot about her.
Yeah, you forgot about it. Well, it's I'm not surprised, because she only got, what, like 6 minutes in an episode that's supposed to introduce her. So, mm-hmm. You know, that happened. So, like, you have, like, the three main white leads. You have the white cousin of the white girl lead. You have the white hero, new hero that's supposed to be introduced. She's a lesbian, but she only gets 6 minutes, so that kind of, like, plus and minuses, that balances out to nothing. And then you have James only got one scene in Supergirl episode. Diggle got to cross over, but he didn't have any kind of role other than, you know, one action scene, and the other one he was just, like, you know, fan, basically, of Black Suit Superman until he got knocked out in an elevator. Cisco had probably him and Iris in her one role within the Flashverse got the most the most story in Supergirl, but it's still kind of glaringly obvious that they don't really get much to do, and they don't really incorporate all of their casts very well integrated throughout the crossover. And then conversely, you have, like, Iris and Candace. And I had a couple of nods that were saying, like, well, you know, maybe she didn't want to be in the crossover. You know, she says it's a lot of work and it's a check. Like, I'm pretty sure that she wants a paycheck. And she's always talking about wanting to work with people from the other cast. She's always pushing for more stories for Iris, and so it would just, it just seems like, you know, kind of a cop out to say like, oh, it's a lot of work, she probably didn't want the paycheck. Like, if I'm working retail during Christmas season, it's a lot of work, and I'm working on time when I could be home, but I also get holiday pay, it's a paycheck. And so I feel like it's the same thing. And you know, a lot of people rightly blame, like, AJK and this year's Mark Guggenheim, primarily. He was consultant, quote-unquote, for the crossovers. But, you know, how, like, how much blame is he going to take? Like, when are you going to also, like, look for the showrunners that are, quote-unquote, letting him make these decisions? It's still their show. So why are they just, oh, we'll just placate the Flash fans and have Iris be heavily involved there. Maybe they won't notice that she's not involved anywhere else. Well, we do. And instead of doing that, why don't you fight for stories for your characters? That would be nice.
Yeah. And of course, you've also got Berlanti, who oversees everything and mm-hmm. should have total say over it, you know, and clearly does not care to have a say or to make it more equitable in terms of diversity.
Yeah. And in terms of Mark Guggenheim, actually, I did notice that at least on one of the episodes I was watching, he was no longer credited as consulting producer. He was credited as executive producer. So at least with regard to the crossover, he had obviously much more power. And you're right, in terms of like the other showrunners not speaking up and saying like, no, we need these characters to cross over as well. Because a lot of fans I've seen argue over how the crossovers are about the supers, which it's not. And then about how it doesn't make sense for Iris to cross over. That's bullshit, because in Supergirl it's very obvious she could have like played an alternate version of herself in
Central
City.
Central City. And they even said like Black Suit Superman's like lair or whatever was still Star Labs. So let's just make it even more obvious that you're in a place that you could have utilized Iris and you chose not to because you didn't want to cut her a check.
Yeah.
Just be clear about it.
And then they include, like, other characters. Like, I got annoyed, you know, the whole Legends cameo. I'm Gary. Like, you have Gary up in here, but you can't include any of the other characters? Are you serious?
Yeah.
Like, why does Gary get to cross over? That's just bullshit. And it's just super frustrating because it's a clear pattern. It's not like, oh, one thing where it's like, oh, well, we didn't make room for her here because of all of the stuff. They were off-world. Like, if they were fighting in space, I can maybe understand why,
but not
you know, right. But, like, it is still on Earth 1, and if you can make room for characters who are going to get knocked out or barely say any lines like Diggle, then you can make room for Iris in a storyline that centered the, you know, Barry and Oliver's identities. So it made sense, it made the most sense for her and Felicity to be part of the crossovers, even more so than other characters. And I think what annoys me the most specifically about the Flash characters is that every single one of the original cast members got to cross over except her. They even made space for Tom Cavanaugh to play Reverse Flash in the hallucination scene. And so if you can do that and yet you won't cut your black leading lady a check, that's what pisses me off. So there's no excuse.
Elseworlds so white.
All right, we'll shade some more of the Elseworlds so white later on in the crossover episode. Moving into Anna Diop on Instagram, she posted thanking fans, critics, coworkers, and like the LGBTQ community for the outpouring of love and support she's received. For like, she was talking about how many people have messaged her about what it means that they're seeing her play Starfire, and that she, you know, got very emotional and she's very happy for the love and support after all the hate that she was getting beforehand. So that was a really nice post. And then of course Minka Kelly and Connor Leslie also made Instagram posts about how much they love her. And when we say this is what women supporting women looks like, the DC TV ladies can take note.
Yeah. That is women supporting women. And you can even throw in Ryan Potter in there as well, because he's very supportive of Anna on his Instagram post and, you know, being a stan for her. And that's like the support that I wish Candace had growing, like, especially in like season one of The Flash. like when you talk about, you know, feminism and women supporting women and supportive cast and just, you know, especially with Anna and the role she's playing, Starfire's new, even, she's an alien, first of all, she's orange, and so you wouldn't think that she would have this kind of hate coming into a comic role, but just seeing the kind of hate and everything that she went through, to have your cast like that back you up, it makes your job, I'm sure, a hell of a lot more easier when you have that support. And it's not even, like, you can't even get into, of course there's going to be ship wars, because there's always ship wars, but I, for me, as a fan watching it, it makes it better for me knowing that Minka Kelly, behind the scenes, is as supportive of Anna as, you know, she is in front of the camera and behind the camera and everything. So it just makes a ton of difference when you're talking about, like, support in the workplace.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right. So hopefully the DC Universe ladies can continue being examples, because that's really great. Moving on,
and hopefully the show can support them on screen.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. We want to see that. We'll also talk on screen. About that. We want both things.
We'll talk about the Titans. You know, they do good on one thing with the cast, but the writers, we're going to have a discussion.
Yeah, exactly. All right, moving into our feedback with Gumption. We got an email from Shane, who gave thoughts on every part of the crossover. So for part one, he says, me watching West Island and Clovis, maybe straight lives do matter, which I thought was hilarious.
Straight lives
matter. He thinks part two was decent, but he had expected more action, especially during the Arrow episode, seeing how Arrow usually has the better action coordination. Didn't think there was use for Nora Freeze, because they could have just done away with her. Like, anybody could have broken the test tube and let the hallucination begin. It left him wanting more Batwoman as well. So, and the pacing was too slow for part two. For part three, he says, was it so hard for Kara to have busted herself out and then fought Black Suit Superman? Like, she defeated a version of him before, so she can do it again. And it's her show. Why did we need a Superman versus Superman? She could have used the book as well, which we'll also get into, because we feel the same way, Shang. And I hate how dumb they had to dumb her down for Superman, and thinks that the Danvers sisters really are the heart of Supergirl, and he loves it. For, let's see. How is it, he says, that we're getting Crisis when Barry only disappears in 2024? Is there another Crisis, he asks. He needs answers. and thinks, in general, it was an okay crossover, but it was quite interesting.
Quite interesting. Right,
yes. So thank you, Shang, for your feedback. We'll post the rest of it to our Tumblr. Yvonne also sent us an email. Hashtag Elseworlds so white. She says she just watched the final episode of the crossover and has to say she quite enjoyed all three episodes. It's always fun when characters get to play different versions of themselves and get different hair. Cisco and Killer Frost cough. she might get into specifics later, but overall thumbs up and excited to see what they do with Crisis next year. She addresses the Elseworlds so white hashtag, but we'll leave all of that to Tumblr as well. And then Swara sent us a DM.
Swara!
Yes, which, hold on.
Who you can listen to weekly on the Flash podcast.
Yes, he's lovely.
If you want more Flash thoughts.
Nice little plug there.
Thank you. I tried.
Swara says that he only watched Legends and Elseworlds so far, appreciated Charlie having the main spotlight, and loved watching her relationship with Zari, who is his favorite character, develop. Do we think the Legends writers may bless us with another queer relationship on screen, but now between women of color, he asks?
Charlie!
I hope so.
I feel it in my bones.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
It would be nice, because we got a little bit of it, so I feel like that could develop. And he obviously thinks it would be such a great step forward with regards to representation. The crossover as a whole was fine, but all the women were shafted, most glaringly Iris. The disrespect the Bebo-verse continues to give Candace is horrendous. And while he enjoyed some of Kara's
calling
moments...
Calling it the Bebo-verse is disrespectful when we're mad at it.
While he enjoyed some of Kara's moments, she did not have anywhere near the writing level of Barrier or Oliver, unfortunately. And Ruby Rose as Batwoman has been middling so far. Hopefully we have a story of these world's finest that... worthy of their status. Thank you, Suara, for your feedback. Always lovely to hear from you. And I think that was all the feedback that we have this.
I do want to say that Juliana Harcarvey, she reposted on her Instagram and I think on Twitter a fan art that someone made of Dinah and Laurel, like black and white canary. Well, Laurel's in like a white canary suit, but of both of them. So basically, Juliana understands my kink. Even when they are not on episodes at all and they don't cross over, I still get fed with my Dinah Laurel costume. So that's my PSA.
We also want to point out that KJ didn't send us anything and Tati says she misses you.
Yes. I am not the only one who misses him, but we just want our... lovely listeners to know that KJ is not mad at us. He just can't send us feedback right now.
Yes.
Because he's on the trip of a lifetime.
So we miss your thoughts, KJ.
We wish you luck. Yeah, everyone is crying. They're just trying to hold it in for the recording. But sometimes it's hard. We wish you well.
Tati's the actress of this group.
Why are we all talking about acting?
I'm kidding. We love you, KJ.
This is life.
All right, and one and on Tumblr did ask us what other DC characters we'd like to see in the Arrowverse, and I remember answering these a while back, but if you guys want to give us any more characters you'd like to see introduced, who would they be?
With Batwoman coming, I want to see Cassandra Cain, and I'm going to assume we're seeing Renee Montoya, but I would love to see a TV version of Cassandra Cain.
I think this is the one that I answered before, but Power Girl, and Tanya Spears Power Girl, not alternate Kara Danvers Power Girl, but I'd like to see her for Supergirl just because I think that they need the diversity. And I would like to see her as a series regular, someone that Kara could mentor in her own image. So,
yeah. Did they ever introduce Zatanna to the Arrowverse? No. Right?
No,
they have not.
Okay,
no.
So Zatanna would be my choice. I would love to see
Zatanna.
Her.
Yeah. She's awesome. Also, of course, I would love to see Bart and Jenny.
Yes.
After they have seen the Tornado Twins.
Or Dawn.
Dawn first.
The other Tornado Twin.
the other twin. All right. So, as usual, we're going to break down all the episodes. We're going to talk about our likes and dislikes and crown our Lady with Gumption of the Week. So, we're going to delve into Side A, Lightning Rod, World's Finest, / Pinky Swear. Take it away, Jessica, who is our host for this lovely episode.
Yay! We're going to Elf World, people. So for this, of course, you've got, the episodes are going to be in the order that they aired. So it's going to be Flash, Arrow, and Supergirl. And then the predictions. There is no predictions for Flash and Arrow because you saw those episodes already, so we'll save those predictions for the winter premieres at the end of Side A. So first we're starting off with The Flash, and the recap the synopsis for this episode is epic Elseworlds crossover kicks off tonight when Barry Allen and Oliver Queen wake up one morning and realize they have swapped bodies with each other. The two set off to find out what disturbed timeline to cause such a shift. However, things quickly go from bad to worse when they present their case to Team Flash and the gang doesn't believe them. Barry and Oliver realize they need Supergirl's help and travel to Smallville on Earth 38. How did they know that she was on Smallville? I don't know, but they found out and went over there. where they end up meeting Kara's cousin Clark Kent and intrepid reporter Lois Lane. LaMonica Garrett guest stars as the Monitor, and Kevin, I cannot pronounce his last name, Tancheron, directed the episode, and it was written by Eric Wallace and Sam Chalson. So, That is pretty much what you missed on The Flash and Neat Little Bow. What did we like about this episode?
Tati, would you like to go first?
Sure, I could go first, even though everything I've said is reactionary to what you guys will say. But time travel is real. So I will say this is my favorite part of the three parts of the crossover. I thought it was the one with like the most consistent tone. And it also felt the most like an episode of the show that it was supposed to be. So even though I'm still a little bit bitter that they put The Flash first and on Sunday, which made it have the lowest ratings of the three in order to boost the ratings of the other two, I still was able to isolate my feelings enough to enjoy this part of the show. I like that it really just felt like a fun Flash episode with everything dialed up to 11. And it was done that way so that Oliver could feel the most uncomfortable about things. Like, people are like, oh my god, how come Barry and Iris are touching when they don't touch normally as much? Because they do touch a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that's so that Oliver could be uncomfortable, right? Or like, why is everyone talking about their feelings? Touch is my love language. Let's go out into the hallway to see what how you're doing.
Or you know? Iris saying, like, his abs are all hers.
And yes, his abs. Yes, all of this was just so that Oliver could die inside. And it was hilarious. Steven, you know, Steven was very funny in his reactions, and his and Candace's chemistry was really fun. Like, it was really nice to see them play off of each other. I'm not saying like, oh my god, I ship it so much, what a great OTP. No, but it was really fun to see that back and forth and to see Candace like going overboard and Steven, you know, trying to back off for everyone's sake. And of course, Steven and Grant had so much fun, and I think this is one of the episodes we got to see them have the most fun because the stakes were the lowest at this point in time. I really loved, like, of course, that whole scene of Barry, like, threatening Oliver, like, if he touched Iris, you know, and Oliver not saying he already did, but, no, I didn't. Nothing's happened. But you thought about it. All that stuff was super, super great. And I think the whole episode could have just been, like, Steven, Grant, and Candace goofing off. But the tone kind of shifts, or the, you know, the intensity dials up when it's Grant and Candace, you know, because then things get more serious with Barry and Iris, which I always love, that no matter how silly things are, they can always ground the episode, and they can always make their scenes feel like the most important thing that's ever happened. I really love him reminding her of her faith in him, you know, like, I need you, you believed in me when I was 12, 11, 10, we never know what age he was because he changes it all the time, and you should still believe me now. And also, of course, calling her his lightning rod, and then that, you know, Caucasian caress, as people like to say, before he goes off to Gotham. I really loved that. I was like, you know, I was just like dying, squeeing inside, dying of happiness. And I also really liked Cisco and Carlos. I have to give him a shout out because, like, that whole moment with the hug when he's like, no, I'm over Cynthia, but thank you for thinking of me. I'll be all right. And then he just like holds the back of his head again, like the most extreme version of Barisco, just so that Oliver can die. So great job with Carlos. And I really loved Iris getting to be active and also showing off her various forms of intelligence, right? Like, she locks them up. And does so without them noticing, right? So she's got her leadership skills are on display. And then, of course, her speech about Felicity being in pain and how Perry is a better husband than Oliver, at least, which serves, like, dual purpose, right? Either she's honestly talking to Barry or she's talking to Oliver. And either way, it works. And then, of course, her telling Barry not to lose himself, right? Being like, I heard you said that thing, and that sounded super Green Arrow, and I didn't like that. But once again, we see how emotionally intelligent she is and not just how quick on her feet or quick on her brain, you know, quick on her feet in the brain way, not in the Flash way she is. And like I already mentioned, I really love, you know, Grant playing Steven or Barry being, you know, king of petty jealousy. But once he has to face Iris, it's a totally different story, right? It's all hearts and rainbows. He's not going to be like, don't touch Oliver, the way he is with Oliver. And he looked really good in the Arrow suit. Like, I don't know what was going on there, but it was working for him. Definitely in a way that the Flash suit was not working for Steven.
Yeah.
I loved all the callbacks, especially the Smallville theme song. Like, I screamed in delight when you sort of heard somebody save me. And of course, Barry shooting Oliver in the back with arrows, get like a joke 4 years in the making. Even though the writers of this episode have only been with us for a year, because it was Sam and Eric, they've only been there since the start of season four, mm-hmm. you could really feel from this episode that they are fans of not just The Flash, but of superhero shows and comics in general. Mm-hmm. Definitely was one where the homages felt like they were honoring the things that they love. And speaking of one of those things, Clois was really nice to see. I know people have had, you know, people have said their things, but I really like both of them. I thought that Lois was a lot of fun, and I liked their chemistry, plus the fact that she got to join in on making fun of Oliver. And everything, half the humor was at Oliver's expense, and I was living for every moment of it. Finally, I liked that we got to see the four major heroes of the episode come together in a fight at the end, but we have issues with that, which we have previously discussed and which we will continue to discuss.
Yay.
Nice thought.
Very nice.
Thank you.
I really like that this episode had a lot of comedy. I think they really leaned into the ridiculousness of the situation and didn't try to take it too seriously. And I think that was to the benefit of the episode. And even though it was crossover, like Tati said, it still felt like a Flash episode because they kept in the most important parts of the show. Like you said, that the grounding point and the strength of Barry and Iris's relationship. And I loved the whole loft scene and Oliver's like, what if Barry sees? Like, he wasn't even concerned he was kissing Iris, but was more terrified by the fact that all hell would break loose if Barry walked in on them. And her finally getting to cook on burnt pancakes only for Oliver to sniff and not eat them, I thought was really funny. Like, so we'll never really know if they were actually good pancakes or not, but at least that was a very Barry move of him to compliment her cooking. I like that Barry was hyped about switching places with Oliver until the reality of the switch came crashing down on him. And for Barry, it's everything but Iris, and the scene where his whole attitude changes about the switch was hilarious. And this episode also had some of Grant and even Steven's best non-verbal acting. Like the Star Lab scene where Sherlock goes to, you know, to call a team meeting and really Barry, real Barry is trying to convince Iris, but she's like, I only have eyes for you, to Oliver was kind of goal. And like, I'm positive Steven broke character for 2 seconds as Barry tells him not to touch her. And also because he already had, so it was great to see petty, jealous Barry come out during this entire episode. Barry coaching Oliver on how to talk to and convince Iris was great. He looked so torn, but also ready to see if it would work. Iris figuring out something was wrong and coming up with a plan to knock Oliver and Barry out until they had things sorted out was great too. Like, she's truly a strategist, and I like that she knew something was off with her husband and came up with a way to stop them both temporarily. She also figured out that Amazo was using their powers and was also probably absorbing their weaknesses. So if anyone wonders why she's team leader, these scenes of planning and figuring things out is the reason why. What made me really happy too was the scene right before Barry and Oliver try and escape Star Labs. We know the pilot, I believe, used Baby West Allen's scene was cut. So it was nice that they had a callback to it in this episode. And that was, it was used to convince Iris that Barry was who he said he was. Like, the tears in her eyes when he called her his lightning rod, acting.
It really does work. It really does work. That one line.
Yeah, it was just really a heartfelt and sincere moment that really screamed soulmate / we find each other on every Earth's reality trope that they have going on. Also really funny, Oliver was kind of skulking in the background looking a bit like the uncomfortable third wheel. And his reaction to Iris' enthusiasm over his abs, I felt, was an ad-lib by her, just to keep that joke going. And the scene where the team is just standing in the doorway is really comical. And I also love that they're so unbothered by Barry and Iris' touch as their love language selves. Cisco also going in to hug Oliver was just so extra, and I loved all of it. The Smallville theme song really brought me back. Like, the nostalgia, the Kent farm, the confirmation that Martha Kent was alive and well. The intro of Lois being the one working on the tractor was great because it immediately swapped traditional gender norms, and I greatly enjoyed their chemistry and banter together. Kara introducing Barry and Oliver to Clark and Lois, and Oliver puffing up his chest and Barry looking excited to meet the super cousin that he shaded in the duet crossover was fantastic. When Barry got his payback on Oliver, I was like, yes, finally. It was just a really great payoff after 4 years of waiting. Lois's enthusiasm over Barry trying to beat Oliver was exactly the way I felt too, because of his behavior during that scene. So Lois knows what's up. And finally, I obviously loved the final scene between Barry and Iris, and how she said that she finally started listening to her heart. And the parallels to season one with Barry's mask line was great too, because he can't wear a mask with her without her figuring something out. And of course, the reminder of not becoming Oliver Queen. Like, they know what they have together, and it's really beautiful. And I had no idea Barry going to touch Iris's hand could be so moving. Like, what the fuck? Their chemistry. and Kara and Barry poking fun of Oliver's gruff voice was hilarious. I'm the Green Arrow.
Yeah, I totally agree. I love, like, just, you know, Barry and Kara are kind of, they're like, you know, well, we call Iris and Cisco Sunshine Twins and within fandom, but, you know, Barry and Kara also have this really, you know, great chemistry together, and they're just, like, fun, like, happy little puppies, so it's really nice. And it's also, like, you know, them, Oliver's, like, the Eeyore of the group, and so, like, them poking fun at him, it just makes it all, like, really funny. The whole tone of the episode, I think, was really light, and it was, you know, comedy-wise, I think it played off really well off of all of the characters. So they wrote all the characters pretty light and pretty funny, and within the comedy within their characters' comfort zone. Of course, like, Oliver waking up in the West Island bed and discovering that he's married to Iris and has super speed was hilarious, that whole sequence. And there's also, like, a moment that is funny, but there's also, like, a moment where he looks in the mirror and notices that his scars are gone, which is really kind of soft because, you know, like, he's got, like, a lot of scars from being Arrow. So, like, that moment when he just realizes that he doesn't have any, I thought was really soft. I thought it was funny. Like you guys said, his first reaction to finding out he somehow switched with Barry was to just go with it. Like, when he's talking to Iris and she's like, I love you, Barry Allen. He's like, I love you. Iris West Allen. Because I'm Barry. So I like that he just kind of went with it. He didn't even, you'd think that he would just, like, immediately run to Star City, but he's like, nope, I'm the Flash now, so I guess I gotta do Flash stuff. I don't think that Steven ever really gets to do any comedy on Arrow, because Arrow's not much on light and comedy kind of show, but watching him try to figure out how super speed works and kind of flail around at being a metahuman was, like, really, really entertaining to me. So I thought it was a good acting exercise for Steven, I guess, getting to try more comedy. And I like how it's canon that Barry and Iris are so touchy and feely with each other that the rest of the team just finds it, like, completely normal. They're like, oh yeah, that's how y'all are, just touching all over the place. Barry finding the fun and the humorous side of him and Oliver switching lives until Oliver lets slip that he woke up in bed with Iris, which technically he didn't, but, like, Barry's reaction to that is priceless. And you could tell, like, as soon as Oliver said it, like, he knew, like, oh shit. Like, as soon as it came out of his mouth, like, oh shit, I fucked up. And like, you know, of course, like, Iris reassuring her man that Oliver isn't her type, and Barry being, like, so exasperated and he was pressed when the team kept calling him Oliver and threatening Oliver to touch Iris. Like, Petty King was on full display, and it was great. You can see the difference in Barry and Oliver with regards to, like, relationships and how they deal with it. Because Barry's, like the rom-com, kind of, like, cheesy romantic, and him trying to coach Oliver and how to, like, woo Iris. And speaking of Mrs. Flash, like, she surprised me. She surprised the hell out of me and Oliver and Barry when she came up with the plan to, like, knock both of them out and throw them in the pipeline so she could figure out what was wrong. I thought it was, like, really, really very forward thinking of her, because we talked, I had a couple of moms also say, like, well, you know, that's not exactly, like, Cisco tells the Arrow team that, oh, she figured it out right away. Well, that's not exactly how it happened. But if you kind of think about it, like, she knew even as early probably as, like, the hallway conversation where he's just, like, acting weird that something is up. And by the time that he comes back with Barry and they're saying that we're each other, and that's the confirmation. And so immediately from that scene, that group scene, Barry and Oliver run into her by herself with her nanite wine already set up. She already had a plan. And, you know, Ralph was on standby to knock Barry out. So there was already, like, a plan in motion. So I thought it was, like, really smart of her how she was able to take out these two superheroes because she felt that something was off. So I thought that was really smart on her part. And then the other thing that I liked about that scene was Iris and Oliver, their conversation, and her informing him on how Felicity called her after Oliver went to prison, upset because he made the decision without consulting her. And so it really speaks to her intelligence again, because not only she suspected that Oliver may not be her Barry, but on the off chance that they were telling the truth, like she was kind of, you know, didn't know for sure, but just on the off chance that they were telling the truth, her telling him that from Felicity, it kind of speaks to, like, she wanted him to know the truth, that Felicity really called her up and was like, girl, my man ain't shit. Let me tell you what he did. Like, all this kind of stuff. She's making sure, just in case, I want you to know that your wife told me about what she did. And I thought it was super important for Oliver to hear, because I really feel like he didn't get why Felicity was so mad in that last episode. So hearing it from someone else, from another perspective, and from another superhero wife's perspective, I think really honed in on it for him. And then over on Smallville, I really enjoyed Lois. I liked her introduction a lot. I thought she was smart. She's like a firecracker. She's very feisty. I love the introductions between Barry Oliver and Clois. Like, the Oliver puffing out his chest, I laughed out loud. Like, it was just hilarious. And then, like, on Twitter, there's a true story that came from Thomas Pound, when he said that the whole puffing up of the chest thing was because he, like, passed Steven in the hallway at one point, and he didn't realize until afterwards that he was, like, puffing up his chest. And said something like he did in real life. He's like, oh my god, that's hilarious. Like, they put it in, like, the script. So that was, like, really funny. And then, you know, Barry's revenge at Oliver, 4 years in the making with the arrows in the back. And what made it even better was Lois yelling from the porch, deck him, Barry! And, like, he's a jerk. It was like, yeah, same, Lois. So I was like, and she just met him, and she already knew what was up. I was like, yeah, I like you. So there's things that we liked, but there are also things that we did not like about this episode. What were those?
So I saw a lot of Arrow fans complaining that Oliver was misunderstood as a hero and a character in that episode. And while I agreed to a certain extent, because, like, while I was watching, I was like, I actually kind of feel bad for Oliver that everyone's ganging up on him. But I don't think it's a Flash issue. So, like, people were like, you know, certain Arrow fans were taking out on the Flash and on the characters of Flash, but clearly it happened the entire crossover. So I definitely feel like it's a Mark Guggenheim issue. Like, it's 7 seasons, so Oliver, so to reduce Oliver's behavior as acting out of anger, being a loner who, you know, cannot be honest with his loved ones for the life of him, or just like, oh, he's a killer, is a little, it's reductive, right? As Jessica will discuss more in detail in the future, he is a strategist, and he's someone who makes cold and calculated decisions that sometimes could make his loved ones feel cut off, which is something that Barry would never do to Iris, for example. So we did get that. And he will take things to, like, their logical extreme, right? He'll, like, you know, if he has to kill someone, he'll kill that person, which is also something that Iris does not want Barry to do. So while I can see where the writers were coming from in the episode when they did the, when they showed those things, I think the dichotomy was just a little bit silly. Like, they basically reduced it to, like, Oliver, smile more. Barry, be more ruthless. And now suddenly all your problems are solved. And I don't think that that's really how they were going to get out of their situations. And I don't think they even really showed how that was helpful, right? It was just there for it to be fun, and it didn't actually help them save the day or stop Amazo or do anything. It was just like, oh, LOL, what if Oliver smiled? And what if Barry had gravitas? So, like, okay. Anyway, speaking of, I continue to only mention Oliver and Barry, even though it's supposed to be a triumvirate. So, somehow, for yet another year, Kara was stuck playing the mediator, not really having any real arc of her own. It's like the idea behind it seems to be, oh, well, Kara's already perfect, so nothing needs to change for her. But that's just an excuse for not wanting to delve into her character and to extract something that could be a life lesson for her or that could be an arc for her. And again, I don't think this is like the Flash writers are not to blame for this. This is the whole crossover that has been constructed, leaving Kara out of the real meat of the story. And it was reflected in the previous two crossovers as well. So it's like Guggenheim, TPTB at large. And again, like we've already said, like individual writers are also should stand up and do something to change it. But it's coming from the top, even if everyone is a cowardly, spineless idiot who won't change it. Sorry, I don't, you know, it's very harsh. Y'all are very wonderful people, I am sure, except for some of you, named Guggenheim. Anyway, Oliver is, like, always the center of the crossover and always has the biggest lesson to learn. Even in the season, even in the Invasion crossover, which, if you want to get technical, should have been Barry's crossover, because that's the one where he had the lesson to learn about Flashpoint, they still took Arrow out of it and made that episode all Oliver's life lesson. So even then, no one else can have a continuous arc or have a continuous learning, growing experience. So anyway, point is, Oliver is the one with lesson to learn. Barry is the one who is like the example to learn the lesson from. Either because of his perfect relationship or his perfect life or the fact that everyone loves him, which was like apparently the issue this time around. And then Kara is just like also starring. Like she just fills whatever role needs to be filled. So like in the Invasion crossover, it was like, oh, I don't trust you because you're an alien. And now I suddenly have a problem with that. Okay. And then in Earth X, it was like, oh, there's an evil version of me. I don't have particular reactions to this evil version of me. This is unrelated. Oliver got to have a whole little scene with, like, Felicity about to die, you know, begging him to spare her life or whatever it was that was going on there, so he could have reflections on that. But Kara didn't really have anything other than, like, I'm not racist, other than my other supergirl's racist. Me, no. The end. But anyway. Also, the fact that it was on Earth 1, but they were looking for Supergirl, who's on Earth 38, so why didn't they go to Earth 38 in the first place? How did they know that Barry and Iris were going to get married on that day, and Supergirl was going to come to Earth 1? But, okay, we're not going to talk about that crossover. And then this one, which again, is like, it's on Earth 1, so Kara doesn't have her connections, and literally all she's doing is just, like, playing Oliver and Barry off each other. So I hate it, I think it's super weird, and one day Kara will be at the center of a crossover. But, let's be honest, I'm biased, so hopefully before that happens, Barry will be at the center of a crossover that also includes Iris. Okay.
Priorities.
Yes, I'm You're sorry.
Like, I love
I'm
my sorry. Daughter, but I love my son more.
Listen. I love my parents more, okay?
Yes, okay,
my parents are my parents. And they call
Kara is the
my
cousin.
Daughter Kara.
Kara is the cousin.
Yes, Kara is my favorite cousin. Anyway. Okay, so, which brings us to the Elseworlds So White side of things. So, like I said, Legends was left out entirely. But even if Legends had been included, it would still have been Sarah who would have been fighting with them. And the others would have had, like, maybe one or two scenes. So you have what could have been a fabulous team up against Amazo, but again, it only reflects how white the top of the Arrowverse is. And how white the behind-the-scenes side of things are, too. So we're going to talk about the division between the heroes and, quote-unquote, the help. Like, Iris is Barry's lightning rod, Cisco's technical support, Diggle shows up as Oliver's trainer, and that's it. Because even the Monitor, who could have been, like, a shining point of the crossover, he's supposed to be, like, the villain of the crossover, and then be like, surprise, he's not really a villain, there's an even bigger villain, which could have been its own great story in and of itself. But instead, even he is, like, the help of his side of the story, because all he does is give unnecessary John Deegan the damn book so that he could be like, oh God, I really wish that I could be a sexy hero, but I'm really bad at making myself a sexy hero, so I accidentally switched Barry Oliver's bodies, and also, here's a robot. And Monitor didn't do anything. So you could have just, like, taken him out entirely, and then found out at the end that the book came from some dude named the Monitor, and it would have been exactly the same. So yeah. The rest of my dislikes are gonna, like, just be more of the same in the other two parts, but I will find a way to repeat myself. So go, ladies.
Yeah, I mean, you really touched on, like, the whole thing. I was, like, gonna start nitpicking the actual the episode, just like, and then get into the whole thing in Supergirl, because I had the same problem with John Deegan even being used to begin with. But I'll get into that.
Well,
later.
I had no problems with Flash. That's why I didn't nitpick.
Sherlock trying to give Clark a check to send to one of his ex-wives on Earth 38 was really painful to watch. Like, I cringed so hard. And you already know I think his whole character is pointless this season. And the whole ex-wives shit is just a reminder that they're going to explore that later. And he just kept going. So I was Clark in this scene. Like, who the fuck is this guy? It was super unnecessary and a waste of time. And then the whole fight that Oliver instigated at the Kent farm was kind of contrived. Like, Oliver clearly had a lot of issues he needed to sort through and was angry about a lot of unresolved problems in his current life, but he didn't need to take that out on Barry. Like, especially considering that he was trying to make him angry to prove a point that didn't need to be made. Anger doesn't help anyone, and it's not like it's been serving Oliver well over the years either. So dude just got out of prison, but sure, let anger drive you. I think it was misplaced to assume that Barry also needed to learn Oliver's way of dealing with things. Like, Barry's just fine being who he is, empathetic, sensitive, and full of heart, and there's no need to change him into someone fueled by that anger. Amazo is such a great villain, and I think wasting him on one episode where he's defeated so easily was frustrating. Like, this is a robot who can steal their powers, so it should have been far more intimidating and daunting a task to take him down. Like, they could have given Amazo a 3-episode arc down the line to do it justice, but they don't want to be great. I was also a bit weirded out that they made no mention of Nora, which was strange. Especially since she debuted in last year's crossover and her whole plot involves the future headline of Barry disappearing in a crisis, so she should have at least gotten some sort of mention. And instead we had Wells version 58. Also didn't like
that she should have showed up as a different actress who looks like a child of Stephen and Candace.
Oh, that would have been funny. I also didn't like that they didn't have Iris obviously being the one to go to Earth 38 with them, because that would have made sense after her discovery of Oliver not being Barry. Or hell, they could have used Iris to bring them back when they discovered Amazo was a problem they had to deal with. Like, it's not like she's never used the extrapolator before. And the idea that Lois was right there and they didn't have her and Iris meet will forever make me salty. It was a big missed opportunity. And also didn't like that the only way Oliver could think to see Felicity's point of view is through the eyes of Iris. Like, he didn't even mention her once. She had to bring her up, which I thought was really weird. And finally, and this is a nitpick, Lois's dialogue about equal pay and whatnot felt forced only because the writers were trying to, like, make a point, and these are all men, usually. And I'd rather they show us and not tell us, especially given that she only appeared briefly throughout the entire crossover, which was annoying in general because I think they should have introduced her on Supergirl prior to the crossover. So that would have made far more sense to flesh out her character, who, while iconic, is still new to the Arrowverse at large.
Yeah, and I think also about that conversation with Kara, it's funny because I think in one of the interviews that Bitsy did, she was saying that, I think either she was saying that, or I don't know if it was like a preview from like TV Line or one of those sites, but they're saying that, oh yeah, Kara and Lois get to talk about their careers, and like, oh, so that was it, that one line, and they're not going to bring it up again.
You like writing stories too, Kara, don't you? Yep.
He is. Yeah, so Amazo, I agree with you, May, that I thought he was wasted in this crossover. I feel like he could have been a more formidable villain, and he was just dispatched overall fairly quickly. And I know, like, one of our nons mentioned that, I think it was in the comics, the lesson of fighting a robot that could copy all of their powers was to figure out how to defeat themselves, basically, because they have all of your powers. So it's a little bit like, you know, Batman coming up with all of, like, the having a list of everyone's weaknesses, so just in case someone went bad, that he would have a plan of what to do. And they could have done some kind of lesson. That could have been a lesson to learn with this robot. But then you have, like, instead, Sherlock coming up with computer virus and turn it off, which just feels like a little bit of a cop-out. So that, you know, and the fact that Sherlock came up with it, it makes me like it even less. I think, like, the other villain of this episode was mainly Oliver versus himself. You go back to Smallville, the whole argument of Oliver trying to instigate with Barry was just, like, ugly. He was just trying to wind Barry's gears, but it just really speaks more to his own issues than he was trying to take out on Barry. I don't like the Oliver's... Let me learn how to talk. Back up.
I don't like... You.
Thank you. I don't like the writers trying to build this whole they need to take on each other's personalities thing and then base all of our superheroes in anger. Like, Barry doesn't need the character trait. Thank you very much. It's not working so well for Oliver, so why would we put that on Barry? That does not make sense. And then angry Oliver may have made sense as his driving force in season one, but this is season seven. So, like, you know, what you were saying, Tati, about how some people, Arrow fans were upset about how, you know, the writers, and they were upset, the Flash writers, but it's, you know, they were roasting him on his own show as well. So it's clearly an Elseworlds crossover issue.
Everyone hates Oliver.
Yeah, but they don't understand, like, his whole arc. And, like, what Barry does need to learn, I feel like, from Oliver is combat training and strategic planning, because neither of those things require anger as a driving force. Because Barry doesn't know how to fight, and he also doesn't know how to make plans. But you don't need anger to do either one of those. In fact, they often require, like, the opposite. So you can't be, like, a good martial artist or an archer if you're reacting based off of anger, if your body is tense, all of that. That's just dumb. So why would you base Oliver's strengths in his anger? And, you know, starting from season one, he may have been angry, and it may have been what was motivating him, was revenge and all that kind of stuff. But moving into season seven, he has love, he has friends, he has a family in his life. And he didn't have those things before. He has them now. So why wouldn't his MO have changed along with his experiences? And I feel like it could have been more of a fitting story if his driving force was something like self-preservation because he wanted to protect his happiness or something like that. Because we already have seen in previous seasons with Barry, and even in this season, with how Nora had reacted to Barry being reckless with his life, how Iris has reacted to Barry being reckless with his life, that is an issue for Barry and for his family and something that he probably could have learned from Oliver. But they didn't want to do that. Like, he could stand to be a little bit more pragmatic and calculating his risk-taking, and that was not the way that they chose. They just, anger, you know, and that's kind of like you said, it's a little bit reductive. So I did not like that for the Flash. And as Tati also mentioned, like, other things will continue to trickle down as we go into the rest of the crossover. So speeding right along to Arrow, this is part two of the Elseworlds crossover. We are going to Gotham City with Batwoman, Ruby Rose, with Oliver and Barry still stuck in each other's bodies. The two get a lead on John Deegan and head to Gotham City with Supergirl to figure out why their reality has changed. While there, they meet mysterious Kate Kane, who provides them with information that leads the group to Arkham Asylum. James Vanford directed this episode with a teleplay by Mark Guggenheim and story by Caroline Dries. Also in this episode, the Geek Squad, which is Felicity, Caitlin, Curtis, and Curtis and Cisco, try to figure out the cause of the lightning storm, and Felicity tries to work through her trust issues with Oliver. What did we like about the Arrow episode?
Ooh, Kara and Barry roasting Oliver for cheating on Laurel and poking fun of him for having powers and still arriving last like he always does was really funny. Like, that's just a running joke, and I like that they keep that up. And I like their banter a lot when it's just the three of them, and they really sold it in this episode in particular. Barry sounding confused about Oliver and Felicity's current strained status was funny. Like, he didn't know if he should be sad. he wasn't even attempting to be Oliver at that point, which is more sad. Cisco and Felicity's same line of, like, I'm being summoned, I thought was a nice little parallel. And Cisco being the biggest West Allen supporter warmed my heart. Like, he was in awe that Iris figured out something was wrong with Barry. He's a proud friend in Stan. the entire scene of Barry and Oliver fighting each other's villains, but really fighting each other, looked really cool. And I like that they used this scene to really drive home the whole walk a mile in my shoes identity stuff that had been going on. Like, it was executed far better than the fight on the farm, that's for sure. Plus, it was a good way to actually utilize Reverse Flash and Merlin without it being forced into the episode. Kara finding it odd that Batman and Bruce disappeared at the same time from Gotham was nice, because it came before she realized that Batwoman was Kate Kane. So yay, Kara and her investigative skills. And speaking of Kate Kane, I liked her interactions with Kara and how easily the two of them got along. I feel like they were definitely trying to make her the Oliver to Kara's version of Barry. Only in this case, the two of them had a lot more in common, being in the shadows of famous cousins and trying to make their own way and doing good despite that. So I wanted more of them together. Though I did take issue with Barry trying to be Oliver Queen in this scene, I did think Barry as Oliver showing off his fighting was nicely done. Like, the jacket, the pop collar, just, I don't know. Something about that was nice. And I like that Oliver didn't move and trusted Kara to catch the bullet, which is growth, considering he didn't trust her two crossovers ago. And Oliver did deserve it when Laurel refused to bail him out of jail. And I love when Barry asked Batwoman if they could hitch a ride in the Batmobile only to get turned down. Like, he's such a Batman fanboy and he tried. I laughed out loud at Barry asking Oliver to keep his identity safe because of the running joke that Barry just reveals himself to everyone all the time. And now he actually cares about people not knowing who he really is. Finally, I like that Oliver and Barry were finally able to see each other's pain and that it was a cause for some reflection on the assumptions they had about each other, and like that Barry told Oliver he shouldn't waste time trying to fix things with Felicity.
Yes, I do like Barry as the relationship guru and advice counselor, because if there's one thing that he does well, it is relationships. Well, one particular relationship, which then he can then apply to other relationships, because he doesn't do the other ones well, but that's a different story. Okay, so I really liked how much fun Barry was having in this crossover, like Grant as Barry, but Barry also himself getting to be a fanboy, like you said, a fanboy of Batman, just like having fun with the whole situation. Like my boss, Valerie, with an accent, a site that all of you should read. She actually watched the crossover. Despite having quit like all of the Arrowverse like a year or two ago, and she watched it and she said like that's the Flash that like that she misses, right? That she missed Barry being like that, and it made her want to come back and watch this season, which I think is a really good sign, because she really hates the Arrowverse right now. So yes. Anyway, I like that Barry's light shined bright in the crossover. Probably because it was thrown further into relief by having him opposite Oliver's, like, mopey version of the Flash. And, of course, like, seeing Barry act like Barry in the Arrow suit, you know? Something that you haven't seen since Smallville. But anyway, I really loved the ribbing of Oliver and Kara getting to join in, having fun teasing him. Her reaction when she found out that he cheated on his girlfriend with her sister was just, you know, very Kara, and also a good reminder to us of what Oliver was like at the start of this show. I also loved his insistence that he was the OG vigilante, just to find out, you know, that Batman was in fact real. And Barry's excitement over the fact that he was right, that Batman was real, his faith was restored. Also, I really liked Kara and Kate's little bonding sessions. I thought that they had a little bit of flirtation, which I was totally 100% here for, and would love to, you know, see again in other scenarios. I like that Kara didn't have to play dumb. Like, she could just come out and be like, yeah, no, I mean, I can tell that you are Batwoman. So, also, there is a Batman on my earth, and there's frenemies. He's frenemies with my cousin, which I thought was interesting and makes me want to know what's going on Earth 38 with that Batman, since we only have, like, that one line reference to Gotham. Give me more. I also thought that the choreography of the Barry Merlin and Oliver Eobard fight was good. I liked, like, the flashing back and forth between, you know, the hallucination versus the reality. I thought it was really nicely done, for the most part, minus one aspect that we'll talk about later. And I also, like, at first I was like, why are they fighting each other's villains? Like, it doesn't even make sense. Like, why are they upset by the things? Exactly. Well, I knew literally why, but I was like, this is dumb. Why are they being triggered by this? But then I was like, oh no, it's like they're finally understanding what the other person's gone through. That's kind of cute. So I did like that. It's like they were literally putting themselves in each other's shoes, actually realizing what they had to contend with, and that the other one is like a true hero in whatever way, you know? Oh yeah, you're a good man, Charlie Brown. and like you said, I liked that Oliver took Barry's advice at the end, that he told Felicity that he will love her no matter what, because that fight last week when she was like, I've changed or whatever. He was like, well, the old you is what I fell in love with. I was like, excuse yourself. You better love all versions of her, motherfucker. So I'm glad that he realized that belatedly and said so. Sisko being number one was Talon Shipper. Now that Joe is down for the count, because obviously he still holds the title. He's just not around to, you know, wave it in people's faces. But that was probably my favorite moment of the whole episode. And then I love how everyone's like, oh, crap, when Sisko just, like, rounded up, and he just kept barreling on, because in the face of Wes Allen, who can stop him? I also loved Kara being right on the money about how you deal with random criminals pointing guns at you, right? You don't need to just stand there and take it, and you don't need to beat the crap out of them either. You can just escape with your super speed. Who knew? And I liked Oliver letting her handle getting rid of the bullet. And also, like, showing so much more respect for her in general than he did when she first appeared. So that was nice.
Yeah, I definitely feel like he's, like, defawed out, you know, with Kara. Like, there's not that kind of wall about, you know, you are a stranger. I don't know you. Stranger danger. And I was like, okay, you're kind of cool. And I agree, like, it's obvious that Stephen Grant and Melissa had a lot of fun working together on this crossover, and I think even there are a lot of, like, little slips, I think, in the Arrow episode where it's clearly, like, Grant just, like, trying to hold it in and like, laughing, or, you know, Steven and Melissa and Grant, like, all of them had those kind of, like, moments where it was just not just their characters, but also them as actors, like, having really fun. All of the little jabs at Oliver's Playboy past were hilarious, like you guys said. You know, like, clearly, you know, Arrow fans were mad about the Flash writers being hard on Oliver, but then he's, like, getting roasted on his own show. So, you know, take that up with management, because the writer certainly liked it and wanted to get some mileage out of it, and that probably could be just Guggenheim that was like, I'm just going to take the piss out of my own show that I made this way, but never mind that. I also like that Oliver thought that Batman was a myth, while Barry, like, the true believer of the impossible, was like, yeah, Batman's real. And he got, like, really excited about going back to Gotham at the chance of meeting Batman. And it kind of reminded me of Justice League War, when it was, like, Hal and Bruce. So Hal was, like, working with Bruce, and they got into this, like, one-sided pissing contest, because Hal's all like, oh, I've got, you know, I'm Green Lantern, and I can do all this stuff. You don't have any superpowers. You're just a bat in a suit. And, you know, he's thinking that, you know, he's better than Bruce at this point. And Batman's just, like, unimpressed and with him and not really paying him any attention. And then, like, later when they get in trouble, like, Barry shows up, and he's like, oh, man, it's Batman. You know, he gets to meet Batman, and, like, Bruce gives Barry, like, a compliment. And Barry's like, oh, he's, like, really happy that, like, Batman is talking to him. And that kind of pissed Hal off. And so, like, that whole scene in Arrow with the whole, like, back and forth between Oliver and Barry about whether Batman was really not, just reminded me of that. And I thought that was really, I don't know if they meant to do that, but I picked up on a callback. So I'm gonna say it's on purpose, and I liked it. And also the fact that Oliver thought that he was the original vigilante. I'm like, oh, that's cute. I like that when they did get arrested by the GCPD, and Oliver's like, no, you just got to call Laurel, the DA, in Star City to bail us out. And I'm thinking, like, Laurel remembered the last time that she tried to bail Oliver out. And she's yes. Like, no, you can sit there and suffer. So I thought that was funny. I loved what little we got of Kate and Kara together. I like that Carr confirmed that Bruce does exist and is frenemies with Clark on Earth 38, and that she pretty much knew, you know, oh, so Clark and Bruce are frenemies. Bruce is Batman. You're Bruce's cousin, so you must be Batwoman. Like, it's pretty easy when you draw the lines. So I like that she was very, like, honest and upfront about that. And there's this kind of, like, kinship that they share off the bat of being the cousins of famous supers and trying to carve out their own identities outside of that. I like that Kara got really flustered around Kate when she mentioned having, like, tattoos, like, all over her body. It was, like, the cutest shit ever, because she was just so, like, flustered and didn't know what to do. I feel like they needed more scenes together to balance out Verity and Oliver's bickering, to be honest, because it got a little much in this episode. And I don't know if Kara realized what she was saying by telling Kate that she used her x-ray vision to check out the rest of her tattoos, or like maybe she'll like realize later that, you know, she's basically saying I was checking you out. But anyways, I shipped the CW Superbat. I think they're super cute together. And the world's finest line, obviously, outsold. That was a great moment between them when they were saying their goodbyes. Cisco and Caitlin letting slip that Barry and Oliver swap bodies, and then Cisco going on about how Iris knew immediately was really great comedic timing. Clearly, Caitlin read the room a lot quicker than Cisco did. And she's, you know, so that was kind of cute. And then the reason that Felicity had to find out this way will definitely go in my dislikes, but I do like that Wes Allen as a couple is so respected by their friends that Cisco's like, of course she knew. They're soulmates, like, duh. Like, it's just like common sense to them. And it kind of, like, reinforces the whole Flash episode when they're just like, you know, you touch all the time, touch is your love language, and how they're just kind of like, it's Barry and Iris. Then you have, like, Arkham Asylum, the hallucination fight that you guys mentioned was really well choreographed. You can tell in general, like, Grant must have had to do, like, a lot of training for this crossover, and it paid off really well. The dual fight between Barry and Merlin and Oliver and Eobard was, like, really, really visually great. And, like you guys said, they each learned some of the other's past hardships through their villains that they didn't know about before. And it felt like there was a real breakthrough after that between Barry and Oliver, getting to understand each other. Barry's attempt at playing Felicity's Oliver was hilarious because he just did not know what to do. But I do like that he advised Oliver to fix his relationship, and that Oliver did it, and that he, like, reassured his love for her and promised that it would be all right, because I think that she really needed to hear that in that moment. 90s Barry, John wants to ship. He was cool for, like, the split second that we got to see him until he was, like, not there anymore. the little twinge of sadness when Barry's like, Dad? And he's like, no, that's sad. But I feel like he only, like, basically showed up to tell us that the monitor dropped the little book off to Deegan, and that, and the little nugget that Diggle is Green Lantern on Earth 90, which, I mean, you can either take that one way or the other way, depending on how you feel about it, but there you go. And that's it.
And that's it.
I don't know how I feel about Diggle being Green Lantern, but that's another story for another time. What did we not like about this episode?
I do like the idea of John Diggle as Green Lantern, only because I feel like it would finally give Diggle something else. but I mean, I can also see it happening. Like, maybe back in season 2, I really wanted that to happen. So it's interesting that they dropped it in there now. But
yeah, I feel like it's like a payoff to fans that really wanted that to happen back in season 2.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, like, we're in season 7 now, and I feel like I personally, I don't even know if I really wanted that to begin with, but even if I did, I feel like I personally moved on from it. And then I also feel like if they make John Diggle Green Lantern, then that just, you know, no John Stewart, no Hal Jordan. And so I don't know. Anyways, back on track. This episode.
Yes. While I liked Kate Kane, I was really underwhelmed with Batwoman's screen time and overall lack of, like, showing us her personality outside of the suit. Like, I already knew that this crossover would be the Oliver and Barry show, but I also had some hope that she would get an introduction like the one Barry got in the scientist episode of Arrow, but I guess that was just too much to ask for because she's a woman. I thought she didn't interact enough with Kara and wanted to see more of that, and even when she was part of the action, she only came in to throw a couple of punches, and that's pretty much it. So they didn't use her to her full potential, and it makes me wonder why, given that this was also supposed to be an introduction to pique interest in her own solo TV show. And it just felt like they used her so that they could name drop Batman and say they went to Gotham, because I know that they wouldn't have treated Batman this way at all. Oliver not confiding in Felicity that he and Barry have switched places is some straight bullshit. Diggle and Curtis were fine with the news, so Felicity would have been too. Plus, it just continued the streak of Oliver keeping things from Felicity, which is why she was mad at him to begin with. So it was probably the worst decision he made all episode. And if anything, he does need to learn from Barry. It's how, one thing he does need to learn from Barry, it's how not to lie to your wife after you did it the first time. While I thought his speech at the end was heartfelt and sincere and one of the best he's ever given, I think Felicity got the short end of the stick because she didn't even get to be mad at him for not telling her about the switch to begin with and didn't get to air out her feelings about the original issue. And this episode in general was just really slow. It felt like a long time before anything substantial happened. I also know that the writers had to add in Danielle because Felicity's like, we need Cisco, and in she walks. In he walks, but with Caitlin also in tow. And I don't think her presence was really required when they had far too many people on the Geek Squad already. Like, her giving lousy advice to Felicity in a scene that should have absolutely been between her and Iris was irritating. And I think I was most annoyed because even Tom Cavanaugh showed up in this episode as Reverse Flash, so all the original Flash cast members were present except for the leading lady. And that's just a bunch of bullshit right there. Who says that love is all that matters when clearly Felicity is affected by the lack of respect and trust? Those are important, and clearly Felicity cares about that. But then Caitlin made the conversation about her and Ronnie, and that parallel is not the same thing unless she's implying they didn't have respect and trust either. So I think it was like a horrible advice from woman to woman. Like, oh no, all you need is love, but no, that's not all you need. And we're also a few seasons removed from caring about that relationship between her and Ronnie anymore. And so the lack of sincerity also made the whole conversation fall flat for me. A lot of the Arkham stuff was cool, but also questionable. For one, and this is just in general, I don't get why Deegan was involved. It's not like Monitor couldn't just rewrite reality on his own without help, and that might have been more interesting to remove Deegan from the equation. And I also wondered why Batwoman kicking Barry and Oliver suddenly stopped them from hallucinating. I thought the fear toxins were stronger than snapping out of it after a blow to the face. They gave some screen time to Nora Freeze because they wanted her to piss off Caitlin accidentally so she could try and fight her and then get knocked out after the literal use of a cold blast. Like, a gun blasting cold air knocked her out when Caitlin has been shown to be immune to cold. If that isn't the most ridiculous thing I've seen in a long line of ridiculous things with regards to the use or lack of use of her powers. I continue to be amazed at the lack of imagination by the writers when it comes to her character. Like, why have her around if she can't hold her own for 2 seconds? So that scene should have been a longer fight between two women who use cold in some way, and it was a missed opportunity, or just take it out. So when people bend over backwards to give reasons as to why Iris doesn't make sense to cross over, I watch scenes like this one and stare into the camera like I'm in The Office. Finally, I thought it was tragic that they only used John Wesley Shipp's Flash for a minute before he went poof. Like, he disappeared, and I thought, was that all? Is he coming back? Because it was so abrupt and underwhelming, and no one made a comment about it, so he deserved better than simply being the messenger.
He absolutely did. I definitely, first off, his appearance also rendered the rest of the episode kind of useless, which I don't know, like, it couldn't have been more obvious that they just needed an excuse to bring in Batwoman. And then to have Batwoman written by not even the person who is going to be taking over Batwoman, I think was disrespectful. Like, and this is like, I can't even say if Ruby Rose's performance was good or not, because Batwoman was not written with defining traits outside of just, like, has cool tattoos and sounds like the female version of Batman in a mask. Because, like, nothing else is going on there. Guggenheim did not give her any, like, real backstory aside from Bruce is missing, which is probably the one reason why Caroline Dries got credit for the story, right? Because I doubt that the rest of it was like, ah, and then this is going to be, like, stuff happening in Arkham, and they're going to fight that stuff. I'm like, no. Nothing else was actually relevant to Kate herself. It didn't introduce any other potential characters for the show, aside from, I guess, Nora Freeze might show up at some point. But again, she could have been anyone, so whatever. We'll talk about that in a second. But the point is that, like, there was, like, a lack of care, personality, or thought given to Kate in the crossover that then kind of made that whole episode feel, like, devoid of personality. Like, it didn't feel like an Arrow episode or really, like, or a Batwoman episode, for that matter. So it was just kind of like, oh, these people that they all know each other, and this is, like, the bridge between the two episodes. So while I said, like, the stakes were really low in the Flash episode, that worked for the introduction, right? But once it's like, okay, we're going to Gotham to find out what's going on, there should have been, like, a revving up of what's going on to reach, like, the big fight for the third episode, you know? And instead it was like, let's go find things out from this chick that maybe slept with Oliver. Oh, well, okay, we didn't find out much. Let's go here. Oh, let's have this totally unrelated fight. And then, meanwhile, the people back at the Arrow Cave found out what's going on, thanks to John Wesley Shipp. Thank you for watching this. And then he just disappears, like you just said. He just, like, poofed away. Like, why did he even come? Just to tell us that Diggle is a Green Lantern on Earth 90. And also, it's Earth 90, and as far as we know, there are only 52 or 53 Earths. So this should be important. Like, this should mean something for the multiverse.
And how does he know his Earth is Earth 90?
So many questions! It doesn't make any sense! Anyway, so it's just whatever. Like, there's, like, as much as it felt like the first episode, Flash, was written by, you know, fans of The Flash, it did not feel like Arrow was written by fans of either Arrow or Batwoman. So, I don't like that. I was going to say, like, if you compared this to Barry's first appearance on Arrow, you know, and how much, like, he came in, like, with his own brand and with just himself enough to make people clamor for a Flash show, right? Like, that's what it should have been for Kate. And even Kendra's, like, long-forgotten role in that first big crossover in the Legends of Today or whatever the hell it's called, like, even if we didn't like it, they were clearly invested in telling that story of the Hawks, you know? I didn't feel like anyone was invested in telling Kate's story after watching that episode. We've already discussed, like, you know, the disrespect that's shown to Candace on these crossovers. That's been a problem that persists across the board, but it's so obvious here because you had the perfect opportunity for Iris to be there to talk to Felicity, to parallel those two relationships. And even though it would have been, like, even if she had been there, it would have been more of the same, right? It would have been Iris supporting Felicity, Iris giving Felicity advice, Iris being the example that Felicity and Oliver can follow, etc. So, like, we would have still complained, but at least she would have gotten a paycheck, and that's what I care about. So in order to have Danielle being the one who's getting paid just to regurgitate, like, a milquetoast line about, like, I don't know, abusive relationships or something, like, that was, like, a really fucked up line, where she was like, oh, there's no trust or respect, but there's love. And as someone who lost love one time, I feel like we should hold on to it. That's why I dated Zoom, after all, because love is what counts. It's like, okay, what? And then also to get knocked flat on her ass by Mrs. Freeze, who, again, like, why was Mrs. Freeze there? Just to give Steven's family an extra paycheck so that their child can have a better Christmas gift this year? Because she didn't have a role. Like, literally could
she
have been
an extra paycheck, but Candace cannot.
Exactly.
Steven gets, like, two paychecks. Candace gets zero.
It just doesn't make sense. Like, why was this person here? Like, I understand why Psycho Pirate was there, okay? I get it. Oh, Psycho Pirate, Crisis on Infinite Earths is coming. But, like, why the fuck is Nora Freeze here? And why did Caitlin get knocked out by a cold gun? I don't understand. If you had had someone else who was not a cold person get knocked out by the cold gun, then great. But instead it was Caitlin. And not only did Caitlin get knocked out, she then woke up and continued to just stare at Barry and Oliver while they were having their fight. She didn't even try to help. She was like, I've been knocked on my ass enough times.
She could use their powers to, like, separate them.
Yeah, no, she didn't do anything. She's like, can someone help me here? I've fallen and I can't get up. So I was like, okay.
I'm scared of the cold, but sub-zero temperatures do nothing for me.
So, I don't know. I just hate. And it sounds like I'm being a hater to Caitlin, because I am. But it's just, like, you could have replaced her with anyone and then also let Iris have the scene with Felicity. And been the one. Because, like, you don't need 300 science people, like, in one little area trying to get John Wesley Shipp to come through like he's Ezra in Batman versus Superman. All right? So, just whatever. Anyway, Oliver not wanting to loop Felicity in on the issue when they were already on the outs because he had not looped her in on an important issue is just, like, funhouse mirrors redonkulous. Like, why are we going through this all over again? Like, I'm actually surprised they made up in that episode, because he was trying to continue to do the thing that he always does to her. And, like, does he never learn? I don't understand. Does he, like, write life lessons on his hand, and then he, like, smudged the last one so he can't read the part that says, stop lying to love my life? He's like, I love all my life lessons, except for this last one, because I can't read it. So, yeah, I didn't like that. I also, like, yeah, like, I, like, they brought, it's not just that it was Jay Garrick, or that it was, you know, whatever, Henry, whatever, which I forgot to say, I did like the moment when Barry said, Dad? That was great. But anyway, so, like, they brought literal Barry Allen from 1990 out of retirement, and then they blasted him to oblivion, like, 2.5 seconds later, which just sort of feels like wasting opportunities. Like, I don't even know, like, did he die? Did he just go back to Earth 90 that's a wasteland? What happened to him? Does anyone care?
I think, like, Monitor actually destroyed Earth 90, so, like, if you blasted him back, like, Earth 90 is dead, so if Barry
so what went back here,
he's dead.
That's so ridiculous.
That's the, like, story. The end.
That was, like, that's, like, again, Batman versus Superman. That's, like, oh, we just put Jimmy Olsen in here and then shot him in the head as a fun Easter egg for fans. Like, what? It's not a fun Easter egg.
Anyway. I'm a fucked up person of fun.
Exactly. So I just, it just felt like they had the perfect opportunity there to begin the coalition of various Earths that's going to lead into Crisis on Infinite Earths. And they did not do that. They just, I don't know, sent him away for whatever reason. So yeah. Okay, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I agree with all of you. That, I don't know, and I'm glad that Shing brought up that it felt slow to him, because I'm like, maybe it's just me that this episode feels really slow, but other people are seeing it as well, so now I know that it's not just me. Kate Kane, like, Tati does, like, a screen, she counts screen time for all of the ladies, mainly on The Flash, or only on The Flash, but in the crossover, she also gets count. Kate Kane got 6 minutes and 40 seconds of screen time in an episode that introduces her and takes place mostly in her backyard. That's ridiculous. 6 minutes. And, like, I also thought it was weird. Like, you're seeing, like, not giving her, like, a personality or any kind of, like, backstory as well. So it's weird that Kate bailed the trio out of jail and then just, like, let them run around in her city. She's like, here. She gave them a place to stay. She gave him the Wi-Fi password. Like, Bruce would not approve of this. Like, I don't feel like this is what should happen. And I'm just saying, like, I feel like there's more that they could have done to show us Kate's personality and how she works as a hero. Give, like, her own brand. So instead of, like, her sitting in this dark, cracked out Wayne Enterprises office waiting for Kara to bring her a clue, I would have liked to have seen her doing more of her own reconnaissance, trying to figure out who the hell these people are in her city, what are they going after, figure out that maybe they're, like, finding her own that they're going after Deegan, maybe do some investigation. So you get this, like, long-ass sequence of Ruby, like, staring menacingly at the camera on her way to suit up, and yet she's, like, fashionably late to her own party at Arkham. Like, she's the last superhero to get there, even though she was the first one to leave. I think that she deserved to have a more of an active role than she got. Like, I would have liked if, you know, because they're all going into the Arkham Asylum looking for the book. It would have been nice if Batwoman was the one to find the book and find Deegan with the book, you know, to make her more part of the story, like, bringing in the whole, like, detective side of, you know, figuring out things. So, yeah, she was way underutilized. And then over on the Elicity side of things, like you guys said, like, I don't like the fact that he chose not to tell Felicity about the body swap, because, like, the reason was really weak as well, because, like, he just didn't want to deal with it. And it's like, what do you mean, like, you don't want to deal with it? Like, it's something that's important that she needs to know. Like, Diggle and Curtis can handle the truth, but Felicity can't. Like, what kind of bullshit is that? And then to back that up, like, Caitlin's heart-to-heart just made it worse, because when Felicity's like, what's love without respect and trust? I was like, yes! And then Caitlin was like, but, you know, hold on. Even though it's a toxic situation, there's still love there, so let's hold on to that. I'm like, your respect and trust are overrated. Like, that was so 2017.
Have you considered just holding on to a man who is alive?
Right. Just pick me Twitter. Caitlin's nose, pick me Twitter, y'all. Like, it's just, like, and it's obvious at that point that Caitlin, as a character, is filling in here for Iris because Guggenheim didn't want to cut the extra check. And that is, like, an issue. It gets an obvious plot point that's important to the crossover, because y'all made it important to the crossover when you introduced it in Flash, And both of these ladies, Iris and Felicity, are involved in that plot point, but you don't want to bring Iris over. And I feel like the conversation between Iris and Felicity would have been a little bit better than, a lot of bit better than, you know, respect and trust are overrated kind of thing. And then I had some anons like, were like, well, Cisco was a bad friend, but, you know, no, he wasn't. Like, you know, it was obvious that Barry didn't even know what was going on between Oliver and Felicity, and Barry's Felicity's friend as well. So there's no reason that Cisco should have known. And obviously he was like oblivious to the whole situation. But I feel like if Iris had been there, then she would have been able to smooth that out a lot better than Caitlin's band-aid over bullet hole approach. Yeah. And I think that, you know, Felicity's insecurities in the episode would have made a better parallel with what was happening, like Iris's like fears about like Barry becoming too dark. All of that would have made better sense, but a bit better parallel if the conversation was between the two women that the plot was actually about. Because I think, like you said, like Kayla was trying to relate it to Ronnie, who's been dead since season one, but I also think she was talking a little bit about her dad and finding out that he's a villain, and that's not even a parallel to Felicity and Oliver. So either way you try to do, whether you try to say that she was talking about Ronnie or her dad, neither one of those parallels work. So it doesn't even work on that level. So there's no, you're trying to fit like a square peg into a round hole in that situation, and none of it worked. And I don't even know why Barry agreed to lie to Felicity with Oliver. You know, like Oliver said, let's come up with a plan to lie to my wife. I don't know why Barry said, we just went over why it's not okay to lie to your wife. Like, why are we lying to your wife? And then when they go to Gotham and Barry went like super Oliver on the Gotham welcome wagon thugs, like, you know, Iris just told you that I don't like you like this, and here he is doing stuff, like, becoming more dark and more the things that she didn't want him to become. And I felt like that at that moment. I really felt Kara's exasperation at both of them at that point, you know. And then that just kind of adds overall to the episode seeming slow, because like you guys said, they just kind of have one conversation in one area, then walk to another location, have another conversation while they're waiting to walk to another conversation, have it in another area. And it's just a lot of wasted movements and characters in the episode, because you have four characters when at most the story needed like two in the Geek Squad that are all speaking over each other, trying to share the same technobabble lines, because there's only so many lines you have and you have more characters than you need. Diggle didn't really have a big presence outside of the Arkham fight. That's all he was there was to fight. That was it. He didn't have really any kind of story or any kind of presence in the episode outside of that. And to be dumb for us. So like Felicity, when they're on the rooftop and he's like, dumb it down. And she apparently tries to dumb it down. He's like, no, dumb it way down. Dumb it way, way, way down. Like he says it like three different times. I'm like, okay, we get it. We're dumb. The audience is dumb. So just like, you know, okay, we're just not going to get it. And then, like, speaking of the Arkham fight, like, this is the second time, and it won't be the last in this crossover where Killer Frost is knocked out for no reason. And if you're going to say that Caitlin is necessary in all of these episodes, utilize her as something that she's actually good at. Like, you don't need her piggybacking off in the Geek Squad, repeating the same things that another person has said. But what you could have used her for, and what you should have used her for, is what she's supposedly good at, being a meta and being Killer Frost, and they can't even do that. So, like, why the fuck is she here? You know, Nora Freeze wasn't even doing anything at that point. She's, like, freaking out. She's not a clear threat. They didn't even have Killer Frost in the Arkham Mayhem with Diggle using her powers there, and then somehow she gets down to Nora Freeze or whatever. Like, Caitlin's not even involved in any of that. She picks on someone who's not doing anything. You know, Caitlin gets minorly inconvenienced by a blast of cold air, and that's somehow enough for her to call Nora, like, a cold bitch and attack her. But as soon as Nora gets her shit together, like, Killer Frost is like, I don't know what to do anymore, let me call help. And, you know, like, she's an ice villain. Like, supposedly she's an ice goddess, and she gets knocked out by a blast of cold air. Like, why, what are you doing with her? Why aren't you utilizing her for what she's actually supposed to be good at? It doesn't really make any sense. Other than the fact that you somehow, for some reason, still feel the need that she must be there and she must get an extra paycheck, but, you know, you don't want to utilize her. And that's really, really frustrating. It's not just like, oh, I don't like this character, so I'm going to say, you know, that she sucks or whatever. But objectively, she sucked in this fight. And apparently they love her and they want her to be in the episode, but they don't want to really utilize her. They don't even know who, I feel like they don't really know who the character is. And that takes me into Supergirl, where she gets really OOC. But other stuff also happens. So for the recap of Supergirl, the battle includes Supergirl, The Flash, and Green Arrow, and Superman engaged in a battle of their lives in the most dramatic way possible. John Deegan has rewritten the world again, so that now he is Superman, Black Suit Superman, and he is ruling with an iron fist, and they have to stop him, and other stuff happens. Jesse Warren directed the episode, story by Mark Guggenheim, and teleplay by Derek Simon and Robert Rovner. What did we like about this episode?
I loved that Kara and Alex were shown once again to be, you know, the true love story of Supergirl. In a different but just as meaningful way as Barry and Iris are on The Flash. So I like those parallels. And I like that they each anchored their respective episodes. I thought that Melissa and Kyler played off each other really, really well. And Kyler especially did a great job of portraying, like, this version of Alex, who has not come into herself yet, but who's still, like, a good person, a brave person at heart. She just hasn't, like, stepped up in her confidence and needs someone like Kara to draw her out and to make her realize her own value and, you know, the meaning that she can bring to this fictional world. And also on the performance front, I thought that Tyler did a really great job with both Supermen, and that the egotism of Deegan's version of Superman really highlighted just, like, how, like, selfless, innocent, and pure the real version of Clark is. I think that this is one of the, like, if it hadn't already been established, which I felt it was, but I think this brought it to wider attention for people, that Tyler's version of Superman and Supergirl's version of Superman is, like, a real, like, a definitive one. Like, it's the most Superman. I think that movies, recent movies, and even, you know, Smallville, because it lasts 10 years, have to play with, like, the fact that, like, maybe there's, like, reluctance there to be a hero, you know, or, like, maybe, like, he's, like, holding back, but this is, like, Clark giving his all, right? Clark's just really happy to be here, and that's what I feel. I feel like that is very, very Clark, in a good way. Once again, I thought that Lois was a fun addition. It was nice to see her, you know, coming in, helping save her man, and then, of course, being like, I knew you would catch me. That was a cute little callback to the first part. Also, I like that they, I don't know, people always, by people, I mean, like, ridiculous men, always bring up how, like, it would be impossible for Clark and Lois, like, to make a baby, or, like, that he should hurt her during sex, or, like, garbage. Right? Because he's Superman. But so, like, they actually kind of brought that up without actually, you know, and also shutting it down. Like, he's like, oh, well, the best place for Lois would be Argo, because then it would not be super. It would just be regular, right? And so there will be no chance that that the baby would hurt her. And I was like, hey, what a nice solution. They're like, I hear your concerns, and they are stupid. Anyway. I liked Oliver, like, fervently believing that Barry and Kara are, like, the best that this world has to offer, even though one of them is not part of this world in order for it to be offering her. But whatever, she's basically been adopted by Earth One. And I thought it was really touching that he wanted to, like, you know, go make whatever deal with the monitor in order to help them. It made me appreciate him more and sympathize with him as a character. And, you know, also it's a little bit sad, right, that he thinks he's the darkness and Barry is the light, but also Kara by extension. Carlos as the boss, like Ramon, was great. He always chews scenery in the best way, and he always carries his weight, right? Like, you always know why he's included in the crossover. So I like how we see him getting the respect that he deserves, and also just, like, having fun with himself, right? He always gets to, like, pay back the disrespect that he receives on Team Flash when he's in an AU. I also enjoyed Barry and Oliver as the Trucker twins. So it was fun for, like, even though it didn't last very long and then he could do very much with it, it was a lot of fun, especially like, Barry almost puking over putting kids in danger. And then
that was really cute.
Yeah, Eric fanboying over them, right? That was fun. I even liked the Jimmy's line. First off, the fact that they called him Jimmy, right? So it's already like, oh, different from James. But then the fact that he called himself Superman's worst pal, which is like, I get it. Like, obviously, it's not realistic. Superman does not care about this rando, but I like a twist on his comic book title. It was really cute. And of course, Brainy's like one-liner. Brainy come in to fight and be like, "Thank you for including me." Or thank you for inviting me, whichever one of that. Because that was like peak Elseworlds So White. Like, even Brainy knows I'm not allowed to be here. I only was graced with 1 minute of screen time in my own show. Thank you. Thank you for letting me.
For that 1 minute.
Exactly. So, I really enjoyed. Okay.
I love Brainy so much. Anyway. Before I get to that, I loved all of Kara and Alex's scenes, but especially the one where she was trying to convince her they were sisters, like Tati said. Much like they anchored Barry and Iris' relationship in the Flash portion, they did the same thing here with the Danvers sisters, and it was a fantastic reminder as to why they're the heart of the show. And I like this alternate Alex in that she was so moved by what Kara was saying. Like, the Pinky Swear story was really so heartwarming and well done, so A+ execution with that. And Tyler Hoechlin playing three versions of his characters. I count three because I count Clark. in one episode was really good. Like, he really nailed Deegan as Superman. I was a little bit terrified. Like, he was just evil so well. And then the real Superman and Clark, and managed to make each of them distinct. And I also really enjoyed the part where Lois showed up with Thor's hammer, because I can't remember what that was. And he was like, "Honey," like, he was confused. Why are you here? And she's like, "Yes, dear, I'm here to save your ass." And then Barry feeling like he had to throw up after doing something bad and trying to hurt people on purpose was really cute. Like, he just couldn't handle the potential of innocent people dying if that plan hadn't worked. And I think that speaks to his character. Cisco, or crime boss Cisco, aka Mr. Ramon, was the real MVP this episode. Carlos really nailed this new version of his character, like he does all versions of his character, and his interactions with everyone were really entertaining. And then using his powers to break into bank vaults has inspired criminal activity, and I love that he had so much self-preservation that he just up and breached his way out of there when shit started to go down. And I liked everything having to do with Brainy as well, even if he was only on screen for a minute. But Jesse Rath made the most of it. His glee over getting to battle Amazo and then thanking them for including him was peak Brainy, I think. And I also loved his exchange with Cisco about their favorite Kryptonian. And I love that Clark also told Kara that she doesn't need an agency like the DEO to continue to do good, because the agency is probably bringing her down anyway. And that he feels confident about keeping the safety of Earth in her hands for a while he's away. So they really have the sweetest, you know, cousin relationship. Oliver believing in Barry and Kara enough that he was willing to make a deal with the Monitor was growth for him, because he's generally such an untrusting person and wants to, like, take control of the situation. But this crossover made it very clear that he's come to trust Barry and Kara even more, but also likes them enough to fight for their fates, part of which is also my dislikes. And even though I thought the general plot was messy, I think LaMonica Garrett did do a fantastic job as the Monitor. Like, he was really intimidating and had a strong presence, even though I think they shortchanged him in general. And the Fortress of Solitude on Earth 1 turning out to be the Time Vault was pretty funny. And I love that the first thing Alex tries to do is grab Barry in a chokehold, because he was going to talk to Kara and she thought he was a threat. And I also generally appreciated the fact that all the alternate versions of the characters got to have different hairdos, because these shows do tend to stick to the same thing, but having your hairdo changed, that's definitely a sign of AU characters, and I wish they'd actually do more of that on a regular basis. So there's my hairdo nitpick. Finally, I also thought Lois and Clark's proposal at the end was sweet, even though I will get into more of that later.
With Barry and the Trigger Twins, I just like the concept of the Trigger Twins. I wish we had done something more with that, but I thought that they looked great. I like the aesthetics. I thought that they looked really, really great. And I agree with you, like, Barry getting, like, physically sick at the thought of, like, even accidentally hurting someone, or, like, doing something on purpose that could have hurt someone was was really cute. It was just like kind of like really peak Barry. Like, oh my god, like it's like if he jaywalked across the street, like that he'd feel really bad about it or something like that. he's just so pure. And then I also agree with you with the other like really nice relationship, because you have really great moments with Carr and Alex, but you also have a lot of great moments with Carr and Clark, and how they kind of relate to each other, and how, you know, she was really nervous about what does she do next, and she was going to Clark for advice, and at the end Clark saying that he was retiring basically to Argo, but he is, you know, he isn't worried about the fate of the Earth because Carr is there and that she can handle it and that she's stronger than he even he is, and so, you know, Earth still has Supergirl. And I thought that was a really nice way to end it for her arc. The small little arc that she got. Cisco, the boss Ramon, was the best. Carlos had the best AU storyline of the entire crossover, I feel like, especially of the supporting cast. And he played the shit out of it. Like, it was great. All of his interactions with other characters, the little ad-libby things he did, like him like stealing, I think he was like stealing like food or something from the Fortress of Solitude, was all really good. And I like that it's a pattern now that every version, just about any version of Cisco that we get, he's like a badass or a boss. So you've got Reverb and Earth 2, you've got Flashpoint Cisco, who is the owner of Star Labs. Now you have Mr. Ramon, or the boss, in Elseworlds. Like some of his lines, I thought Super Dick was funny, and I thought it was like hilarious. Like when Oliver tried to like touch him, like, "Hey, what do you get locked up in Star Labs for?" And like Cisco kind of gave him this, "Did you just try to touch me with your Caucasian hand?" Like, he's like, "Where are you touching me? I didn't think you could touch me." All that, like Carlos just did like a fantastic job, and you could tell like he had a lot of fun with that. Kara and Alex really sold the heart of the episode. And the fact that you have Kara and Alex angering Supergirl, and you have Barry and Iris angering the Flash, it made Arrow stick out a little even more like a sore thumb, with the fact that most of it had Felicity and Oliver on the outs and separated from each other. But anyways, Kara being able to connect with Alex through the Pinky Swear story, even though it wasn't her Alex, I thought the story was cute, even if Melissa's Japanese is horrible. I guess, like, you know, she was in a lot of pain with the ear thing, but, like, so, you know, she said that Alex spent, she said, like, a summer or something in Nagano with her parents, and the Pinky Swear thing is Yubikiri Genman Uso Suitara Harisenbon Namas. So, basically, like, cut off your finger, get punched 10,000 times. If you lie, you have to swallow 1,000 needles. So it's basically like Jesus. Cross your heart. It's like the cross your heart, hope to die, stick a needle in your eye. There's needles involved always, it seems like. yeah, but I like that. I don't know who thought to look that up and make that a story, but it was nice and I liked it. Clois being back in the episode and kind of like starting on the Flash and ending on Supergirl was a nice bookend for them in their story. I thought it was weird that they just happened to be chilling in the Fortress of Solitude. And again, like, how did they even, like, Barry, Oliver, and Cisco even know to breach there? I don't know how the methods of breaching works, but I don't know. It's very accurate for some reason. I guess after 17 tries, then it's really accurate. But I like that she was involved in the discussions with her significant other, and that she later brings reinforcements when they're needed in, like, the action sequence. I do not remember how she knew to bring them there, but she was there, and she brought John and Brainy with her. And then Brainy's sheer excitement of getting to fight a robot that can copy powers of other superheroes, but also remembering to tell Lois thank you for the invitation was adorable. Like, I stand one polite king. It's so great. and then, in general, I really liked LaMonica Garrett as the Monitor. I like the sound of his voice. He had really good presence. It was a nice casting, although I agree with you, May, that he was really shortchanged overall. And then Oliver, his sacrifice and, you know, giving himself up to the monitor. I think it shows a lot of growth for Oliver over the course of the crossover. It's also kind of sad that, you know, he is like, I must die, because I like that he thinks so much of Barry and Kara. But it is kind of sad that he doesn't think that much of himself. What did we not like about this episode?
Oh no. Okay, so we kind of brought up previously how it doesn't make sense that Deacon turned into Clark instead of Kara, because it's Kara's show, so one would think that Kara would have the bigger impact in the story. And I double hated that they lampshaded it by having Kara be like, what, are you scared of my gender? Or whatever. Oh, you copy everything but my gender? And then he was like, no. And then he had nothing else to say and just left and continued on with his plot. And I was like, why didn't you even bring it up if you're not going to do anything about it?
It was like a fifth grade fight.
Yeah. It just made me so mad. Like, they benched Kara in her own episode so that she could have a different version of the same heart-to-heart that she always has with her sister. Which is, like, not bad. Of course, I love that. They're great. But, again, like, that's what should be happening if Kara was the love interest. You know, like, I always use this example or comparison. But the way they treat Kara is like Kara is the love interest to some other dude in the story. So it's like, oh, well, we're just going to fit her in here as a support, as the emotional support, because as a woman, she can do that. And then they don't give her the big fights or whatever, unless she is literally playing the love interest to evil Nazi Oliver in last year's crossover. But anyway, I didn't like that. I didn't like that we ended up having, like, Superman versus Superman, and that Superman was the one that could read the book, and there was no reason why. Like, it's not, like, did Clark have previous experience with the book and with Crisis and the monitor or something?
Kara was, quote-unquote, weak from being in a cell that should not have dampened her powers unless it was, like, infused with kryptonite.
Right. So, like, it's just a made-up BS reason so that Clark can be necessary.
Even if she was weak, John Deacon is a whole-ass human with no superpowers, and he could read the book, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At the very least, do evil Superman if you want, and lampshade the sexism, and then let Kara fight evil Superman as a callback to the season 2 finale of Supergirl or whatever, you know? Like, there was no reason not to let Kara be a more active part of the story. And yes, she got to run around the Earth in order to stop it from imploding or whatever, but that was only so that Oliver could then make his bargain and feel his feelings and hopefully foreshadow his future death. So it wasn't about Kara. And I don't like that. Anyway, back to harp on Killer Frost, because this is the hate on Killer Frost hour. She served no purpose but to run Danielle another check. So it's like, I've talked to people about this, like, I've said this in many, like, chats, but I'm gonna say it again out loud for everyone to hear. I don't feel like anyone in any of those writers' rooms cares about Caitlin or even knows who she is. Mm-hmm. And yet they give all this space to Danielle, so, like, there's definitely, like, some kind of disconnect, because, like, she has to appear in every episode, and yet no one seems to know what she stands for. Like, even Jimmy, who is one of the most disrespected characters on Supergirl, they understand him enough to know that the bad guy muscle, who is Superman's worst pal, is the antithesis of what he actually is, right? Like, oh, here's James Olsen, and now let's do the opposite of James Olsen. Now we've got Jimmy. And then we've got, you know, of course, Cisco. Everyone's aware of Cisco's capabilities. Everyone, like, and how they're disproportionate to the respect that he receives. So he's always the, like, most badass guy in the room in any AU. And again, that's like, oh, antithesis of Cisco. And then there's just Caitlin, and I don't know what Caitlin is. Caitlin / Killer Frost just gives terrible romantic advice and then gets knocked out of the preamble. Like, that's what they see her as, or that's the opposite of what they see her as. They think she normally gets good advice and doesn't get knocked out. I don't know. I don't know what they think, but that's all that they think that she can contribute. In both shows, in both Arrow and Supergirl, she gave someone useless romantic advice, and then she got knocked out. And she could have been literally anyone. She could have been Eve Testsmacher in that scene with Alex. And that would have made much more sense than if she had been Caitlin. And in fact, what would have made even more sense than all these characters from Earth 38 who have never appeared before on Earth 1 suddenly appearing in Earth 1 and moving cities. Now they live in Central City and we don't know why. Even though the Monitor slash John Deegan does not know anything about Earth 38 or right. their lives, so why would he be placing them in here? Would have been for Kara, for them to go to Earth 38, right? For John Deegan and the Monitor to travel to that Earth. Like, well, I guess we've tested y'all. And I guess you sort of passed on Earth 1. Let me go to Earth 38 now. And then to actually have Kara be dealing with her people and a changed reality for her. If you want to make it her episode. Like, there was no reason to continue the fight on Earth 1. The fight. It wasn't even a fight. Whatever, you know. You know what I'm saying. To, like, actually have Kara dealing with her Alex, whose life is different now. And there being the possibility that her Alex will never come back to her. Right? Because in this one, again, it's like, she's on Earth 1. Like, I guess I could just go back to 38 and things will be fine. I could just leave y'all to burn. Doesn't matter. You know? So I don't know. I don't know why they didn't do that. And then that would also explain, if you needed a reason why you're not paying Emily and Candace, that would explain why Barry's not checking on what change is taking over Iris, right? Like, when he was suddenly, that was, like, the only thing he cared about in the Flash episode. But in the Supergirl episode, suddenly it doesn't matter what Iris is doing, because we're going to fix it in 5 minutes. And for Oliver, it doesn't matter what Felicity's doing, even though we just made up 2 minutes ago. Whereas if you're on Earth 38, they don't exist there, so it's fine. Overall, though, the crossover felt like it was a prequel to Crisis on Infinite Earths, but not even, like, a really high-stakes one. Like, I didn't get the feeling that the entire multiverse is going to be destroyed, and we have to stop it, right? Like, we need to get this ball rolling now in order to be able to prevent something horrible from happening in 1 year. Instead, it was just kind of like, hey, what's up, guys? I'm the Monitor, and I'm here to, like, annoy you. Like, I'm like a fly, right, that you have to swat repeatedly until I'll go away for a year and then come back. I still don't understand how the best you can come up with is John Deegan. And then, like, there's the fact that John Deegan became Dr. Destiny, which I guess is cool, right? You're like, oh, that's a Crisis reference. And then there's also Psycho Pirate, who's just, like, hanging out in the jail cell, like, randomly knowing about the Crisis in a year. Like, I guess the Anti-Monitor's already been talking to him. But if you had actually spent more time with Psycho Pirate and the Anti-Monitor, or with, like, an actual Dr. Destiny and not just, like, random racist scientist who then gets his face burned and is now Dr. Destiny, then maybe you would have had a more interesting prequel to what is the biggest comic or DC Comics event of all time. So, yes. That is all. I do not feel like they're prepared to deal with the Anti-Monitor or that they even know what he is or care. Okay, that's all.
I don't know. Like, as I was watching this, I don't know why I thought of, like, Fantastic Four 2, in which, like, Galactus is this big blob of cloud trying to absorb all the different Earths. And that was more terrifying than whatever this crossover was trying to give us. Like, it was creepy. Like, oh, I actually felt like he was gonna, like, eat planets. And this one's like, okay, so I guess, you know, over half of the other Earths are gone now, but we don't know why and no one bothered to ask. and I completely forgot to put this in my notes, but I agree with you wholeheartedly about they don't know what to do with Caitlin in regards to her as Caitlin and her as Killer Frost. And that whole scene with her and Alex was so pointless and unnecessary. And I don't know, like, it was just uncomfortable to watch too, because she was, like, flailing her hands around, and I was very stressed. Anyway. but yeah, like, she's just getting an extra paycheck, and we don't know why. Like, is this a contractual thing? Does she have to appear in every single episode of the crossover just because it's in her contract and not because they actually want to use her? Otherwise, like, they would actually give her something worthy to do. But otherwise, she's just kind of there and in places she shouldn't be. Anyway, I think they really undermined Supergirl on her own show by first making Deegan take the form of Superman instead of her for unclear reasons, and also having Clark being the only one, like you said, who could hold the book and help rewrite reality again for no really good reason. So they claim Kara was still recovering from being locked up, but they make it sound like kryptonite was still in her body or something, so it was stupid and a clear case of sexism, which speaks to the overall issue of Kara having the least focus and story of the trio. So she had to stop the boys from bickering constantly, and that was the extent of her story. There was no reason she couldn't have played an alternate reality version of herself or had an identity crisis of her own. And even Barry got shortchanged because the whole identity crisis turned out to be all about Oliver in the end, and they just used Barry to give Oliver that storyline. They're like, Barry's not really concerned about his identity, psych. The episode took place in Central City and centered Star Labs, but again, Iris was nowhere to be found. Deegan tells Oliver and Barry that he's really changed the lives of their families, and we don't get to see Iris, who lives there and is always in Star Labs. So I smell the bullshit. And they
That really got me. Yeah. He's like, wait till you see how I changed the lives of your friends and families. And then you never see the families.
Yeah, it was so weird. And then they could have replaced Diggle with Iris even and given her more to do, even because when reality was back to normal, her and Barry could have followed up on that balcony scene. But they really don't want to give her that extra paycheck, even when it made so much sense for her to be there and play on an alternate version of herself. Like, again, Gary got to cross over from Legends. There's really no excuse, and the disrespect for her in this crossover was just really, really bad. The Lois and Clark proposal scene was sweet and fluffy, and this is probably just a nitpick, but I can't help but feel it was shoehorned in there. Like, we had just gotten the announcement of them expecting a baby, so I think the last scene should have gone to Cara and Alex, given that it was her show, and the proposal didn't feel as earned, given that we'd only spent, like, maybe 5 total minutes with them as a couple. Supergirl's supporting cast in general was just used far too little, so there wasn't enough Jean, and even Cisco and Caitlin were given more screen time than James, which is ridiculous. And just in general, I feel like the Flash cast gets to cross over the most this entire crossover, whereas maybe only Diggle crossed over from Arrow, and none of the Supergirl characters got to cross over into the other episodes except Clark and Lois. And then Oliver going to the monitor on his own and willing to sacrifice himself made it seem more like he was willing to die because of his past and anger rather than doing something noble. Because to me, Oliver, he struggled a lot, but I don't think it was just a lack of, like, confidence in himself specifically. Unless this was, like, a crossover during the Prometheus time or something. It just seems like he spent the last 7 seasons and multiple crossovers learning the same lesson, and dying might be, like, the only way he knows how to face something, besides, you know, actually changing. And finally, I really disliked the implication that many worlds have fallen, but the one with 4 white heroes has a shot at being saved. It screamed white savior to me, with Oliver being front runner at being the sacrificial lamb for next year's crossover. And while that's exciting, we're getting Crisis on Infinite Earths. The whole crossover plot this year was all over the place and lacked coherency because a lot of things were contrived just so that they could happen. So, you know, just so they can all get together and the crisis could be set in motion. And it was fun in a lot of regards, but also messy. So there needs to be, like, a lot of improvement going into the next one. And by big improvement, I mean, like, a tighter storyline, having Iris respected enough to cross over like the rest of her castmates get to do. And it would also be nice that Kara gets treated like her own person, too, instead of, like, a prop for men's stories in general. Please and thank you.
Well done. Bravo. I do feel like, overall, the crossovers, they always have, like, so much hype. And they have these, like, really good ideas, but they just never execute them well. And a lot of that has to do with, I think, they don't utilize their cast members in, like, the most creative ways. And usually, because it's all so front-heavy on Oliver, or in this case, Oliver and Barry. And so even Kara, it was supposed to be like a trio kind of thing, and Kara's just kind of like off to the side. And it's even like more kind of obvious when you consider like the intros. So you have like the Flash and Arrow intros are, you know, well, they're both Barry because by that point Barry was Oliver. But in Kara's, it's John Deegan's ugly ass like hero's voiceover. I get why he was there, because he rewrote reality, and so now Supergirl is Black Suit Superman or something like that. Like, it's his show now, but it's still kind of ugly that she doesn't even really get to speak on her own intro. And I agree that it's shoddy logic how John rewrote himself as Superman and not even Supergirl. And it's even shoddier when you consider the fact that Kryptonians don't even exist on Earth 1, or they haven't come to Earth 1. In the Earth One universe. So it's weird. Like, how did you rewrite the universe and come up with Superman when you shouldn't even know who Superman is? And then, like, later they came, or, yeah, like, you know, come up with Superman. Somehow you know, you don't know who Kara is, but you know that they're related or something like that. You know that, you know, now for some reason Alex is in Central City. Why is even John in Central City? Like, why isn't he in Gotham? Because that's where he's from. Like, none of that made sense. And then later, like, the excuse about, you know, Kara can't hold the book because she's too weak from being locked up. But that just doesn't make sense either, because, like I was saying, like, unless that cell is made out of kryptonite, she could have broken right out of it. Like, dark matter is not something that's in her system. So why is she, you know, having, why are they making her struggle in this prison cell? And the only logical conclusion is just to keep her out of the plot for reasons so that Clark can come over and save the day. Yeah, so that doesn't even make any sense. And even at her weakest, she's still stronger than Deegan, who is a human, and he could handle the book just fine. So, that, yeah. I didn't like that. I felt it was just kind of like nerfing Kara out of her own story. You've got Alex and James moved to Central City randomly, but literally nobody else. James only gets one scene, and it's as Cisco's lackey. And Cisco has a great storyline, but James, it's Supergirl, Supergirl cast, and Supergirl cast has no stories. Like, the cast in general has less time collectively in their own episode than either of the other casts from the other shows. Like I said, I don't even remember how Lois, John, and Brainy even knew to join the fight at the end, but it's probably just to, I don't know, get Brainy and John some screen time and make it like seem like it's a Supergirl episode, and really they just wanted to play with like the Flash and Arrow characters, and mainly just the Flash. Like, I don't know why Gary needed to be there. Like, that could have been, that easily could have been Iris, you know, the bar owner at like the criminal hotspot or whatever, or she even could have been if we had to have that awkward water cooler conversation, she could have handled that emotional range for a conversation better than Killer Frost, who has a character that's not even her personality as the character Killer Frost. And so it was just really awkward trying to watch, and Danielle felt uncomfortable playing it, to be honest, because she was like May said, she was all over the place, and it was just really OOC to watch this character try to relate in a way that's not natural for them. And again, first of all, I don't think that conversation needed to happen, period. It was stupid, and it was, like, the dialogue, even. Pam from HR, like, her, like, Alex's boyfriend cheated on her with Pam from HR. I'm like, really? And, like, the dialogue was crap, first of all. And it didn't even have to happen, because Kara could have deduced on her own that, hey, this woman looks like my sister, maybe I should connect to her emotionally like I would with my sister. Like, you didn't have to have that conversation to take place in the first place. But the fact that they felt like they needed to put that in, and then on top of that, the only female supporting character that they had available to have that conversation was Caitlin / Killer Frost, because that's the only person that they wanted to give a paycheck to, it just makes it more obvious that, you know, they keep trying to force characters into situations instead of just, like, using more of your cast more efficiently. Like, you don't have to have, like, a crowded crossover with everyone standing in groups one places. There are ways to make it feel more integrated, and they just don't know how to do that, or they don't want to do that, and it's just kind of a lack of creativity and imagination is what it comes down to, pretty much. And even John, like, John Diggle was, like, almost less relevant than Killer Frost. Like, all they did was, like, clap at Black Suit Superman and they get knocked out in an elevator. Again, like, why are you bringing these characters over here if you're not going to utilize them and utilize, like, their strengths? Doesn't really make sense.
He's right.
See what's going down my list. Oh, like, a nitpick. Like, Black Suit Superman's headquarters is still called Star Labs. That just seems like a missed to call it what something else, yeah. Whatever, black, the whole thing could have been, like, the Fortress of Solitude instead of, like, Time Vault. And it just makes it even more painfully obvious that this is clearly Central City, and clearly you could have used other Flash characters, and you chose not to. I liked Oliver's Deal or No Deal scene with the monitor, but I didn't like Steven's. This is also a nitpick, by the way. So Steven's like, I have to shout all of my feelings because that's how you know that I'm serious. He's like, why are you shouting, Steven? Like, it's kind of like the equivalent of, like, Emily when she has to be, like, really emotional, and so her voice gets, like, really nasally. Yeah, nitpicks. And then finally, just overall, like, with the monitor, like you guys said, like, he could have been used more overall in the crossover, but also, it's, why did he choose John? Like, maybe the Earth keep failing because you keep picking garbage people to rewrite reality. Like, maybe it's you. Maybe you are the problem.
Not just that, it makes no sense too, because, like, he has that power to do it. So, like, why use a human? Just sit atop your godlike throne and rewrite reality.
Who knows? Anyway, do we have any predictions for either the Flash, Supergirl, or Arrow going into the winter premieres next year?
Predictions, yeah. For the winter premieres, I don't know about that. I only have predictions for Crisis.
just general. Yeah, Crisis. You want to do Crisis, that's fine.
Because my only prediction is that, you know, Oliver gave away his destiny in exchange for Barry and Kara's lives, so he's going to be the one to die in Crisis. After which,
either Arrow... Do you think he's going to die next year? Or, because I kind of think... I'm debating whether he'll die this year and then he'll be resurrected in Infinite Crisis to fight the good fight, or if he's going to stick around and then die in Crisis.
I think he's going to stick around and die in Crisis. Because if he dies and then is resurrected for Crisis, then that just brings us to the same problem of Barry and Kara famously die in Crisis. So something has to offset that, because Barry and Kara are not going to be the ones to die this time around. Unless, you know, again, they could die and then immediately be resurrected in the next episode of their respective shows, but they're definitely not going to die. Whereas I think that Oliver could die because there is a ready-made replacement in Emiko.
Yeah.
Plus, we already have the flash forwards where he seems to be dead. And people are talking about him like he's long gone, you know, not like he died 2 weeks ago. And then, of course, they still have the possibility of the Lazarus Pits just being like, hey, they're back. We're going to revive Oliver again. So they could just easily do that if they just wanted to stick around with him. I also think that Iris will be pregnant with the Tornado Twins by the end of this season, so that she can be giving birth just as it looks like Barry is going to die, for maximum drama. before, of course, Oliver trades places with him. And furthermore, I mean, there's two options.
Like, if Oliver does die in Crisis,
yeah,
that's once again, like, an entire crossover being centered around Oliver's sacrifice.
It's gonna be, let's not pretend like it won't be centered around Oliver, no matter what. Even if Oliver didn't die, it would be centered around Oliver. So he may as well die for me in Crisis. Do it for me, Oliver. Because no matter what, it's going to be centered around him. Like, they've already proven they don't know how to do anything else, because they are Mark Guggenheim.
Yeah, and it would make no sense not to have it about him, given that he, whatever deal he made with Monitor now, is setting up what's going to happen later. So, like, I'd rather him die than have them try to kill Barry anyway.
Yeah. I mean, they'll try. They'll just fail.
Right, they'll fail.
So now there's two schools of thought with the newspaper situation. I saw someone on Twitter... let me give this person proper credit. Suggest this. And I was like, okay, you know what? This is possible, even though I don't necessarily think this is going to happen. But come, where are you? I thought I liked this tweet. Okay, here we go. Quake Fitz said, the season is going to end with Iris telling Barry she's pregnant and then looking at the article now dated November 2019. Mm-hmm. So yes, that's totally possible. And that would be super cool, dramatic impact for the end of the season. However, I think that Crisis is separate from the newspaper that we are seeing that we've been seeing since season one. And I think the reason we thought it was Crisis on Infinite Earths is because Grant lied, first of all, because he didn't know. No. He thought that was Crisis. But also, it says Crisis in the headline. However, if you read the article, Barry disappears during a fight with Reverse Flash, which is not Crisis. Like, if anything, that would be the moment when Eobard is going to go back to kill Barry when he's little, right? Mm-hmm. And so that Barry follows him to save himself, but is unable to save his mother, and then gets trapped in the time stream, in the Speed Force, whatever it is. Just like Eobard couldn't go home, neither could Barry, just in a different way. So I think that once Crisis is resolved, and Barry is saved from that death, we will then find out exactly what happened in 2024. You know, like how Barry got trapped, until we eventually play it out in real time and get a different outcome in the final season of The Flash.
Interesting.
But yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely plausible. And then there was a section about red skies in the newspaper too, though. That's mm-hmm. like my, yeah. But that makes a lot of sense. Because there's different crises constantly.
Even the crisis. Like, we just had Crisis on Earth X mm-hmm. last year. So, like, there's many crises. There's Infinite Crisis, which is different from Crisis on Infinite Earths. And then there's Final Crisis. Then there's Crisis on Two Worlds. There's many crises.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Do you have any other predictions, May?
No. Yeah. I mean, I totally think that Tati knows more about all the time-changing crises, timelines, all this crazy things that people come up with that I cannot. But I do agree about Iris possibly being pregnant at the end of the season, just so they can have that going into, like, the next crossover, because they love dramatic yeah. births.
And I think it makes sense, because there still has to be payoff for that. We're going to need more diapers line.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Elseworlds, Lady with Gumption nominations. Who is our Lady MVP? Although it's hard because it was a sausage fest.
Yeah, that's. I feel like you'd have to give it to Kara. You know, she did travel. She did run around the Earth to save it and face, you know, the possibility of her own death without blinking. And she was in all three episodes and did something. There's only two women in all three episodes, and she was the only one that did something. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say Kara and maybe runner-up, like, Iris just for her. I'm sorry. She had, like,
good stuff. Of course. Iris is, like, the unspoken, always the lady with the most emotion.
Because of, like, her, you know, coming up with the plan to, you know, knock Oliver and Barry out until they can figure stuff out, and also just being, like, a good strategist in general in the episode she was only relegated to. So if they can use her smarts for the rest of the crossovers next year, guys, imagine that.
Imagine that. Oh, yeah. If they try to do Crisis on Infinite Earths and not have Iris in all the episodes, I will literally go fight them.
Yeah. Just throw it all away. Mm-hmm. Like, as soon as she gets the scripts, she should let us know what the deal is, so we know when to storm the WB offices and the CW offices.
We should start from now, since we know it's going to be Crisis on Infinite Earth, and then everyone should just, like, put out petitions constantly.
Oh, like, we should start storming now in advance. Like, we're going to protest until you confirm that Iris is going to be in all the episodes.
Moving along, we're going to go over to Side B, because there's other things happening this week with other shows. So, Side B is with Legends of Tomorrow, Black Lightning, and Titans, so the B team. It's called Surgical Strike, Booyah, and Housewarming. So, on Legends of Tomorrow, it is the right thing to do. After Constantine breaks the Cardinal Legends rule, you can't change the past, he, along with Charlie and Zari Cat, try to deal with the ramifications without telling the rest of the Legends. Even though Zari Cat encourages them to just fix the problem, Constantine and Charlie are determined to find another way, but only continue to make things worse. There's a lot of AUs, so this is basically like Legends' own Elseworlds plot in one episode. It was directed by Ben Hernandez-Bray and written by James Egan and Ray Tarnichet, is how I'm going to say that name. But what did we like about this episode?
I loved everything for the most part. From the custodians of chronology to the sirens of space time, their theme songs. And then when the puppets of tomorrow showed up on screen, like, I died of laughter. I think this episode really went all out for a mid-season finale, that it almost felt like a finale, but with, like, more of a minor cliffhanger. And I think all the characters were utilized really well and each got their own thing to do. But I have to say, I really, really loved that Charlie, Zari, and Constantine, even though Zari was a cat for a lot of it, were central to the episode, like specifically Charlie and Constantine. And I think Charlie has been struggling this season with using her powers and escaping the magical prison and dealing with the legends and their treatment of her. And finally, this was her episode to really shine. She could have stayed out of it, but she didn't, especially knowing she had her powers back. But when she found out that she was the missing link in the legends, going all assassins on the magical creatures, I thought that was really well done and a well-deserved moment for her to realize her importance and specifically her role in the change in the legends' attitudes. I love that the fairy godmother and her songs were back because I adore her.
Babe!
And I'm really glad they found a way to utilize her again. I also really love that the heart of the story was Constantine and his love for Desmond, because love stories can be very powerful when they're at the center of timeline changing things on these shows. And I think the Legends writers have wanted to do epic and grand with regards to love stories, but don't think they've ever utilized them properly. Like, thinking back to season one with the Hawks and then Nate and Amaya's botched love story last season didn't really work as a grounding point for any of the plots. But I think the Constantine storyline in just two episodes has been really powerful to watch, and also really good at being heartfelt and capable of driving the story. So kudos, writers, for finally getting that right. Nate talking back to his dad, Ava's mourning period, Zari being the voice of reason, and trying to make Constantine see that the story isn't over for him and Des, and that he can be saved without rewriting the timeline, was wonderful. So this is how you do an alternate reality episode and utilize all your characters. So I think next year they should take note.
Oh. I totally agree though. The mid-season finale was equal parts hilarious and heartbreaking, and like you just implied, it did Elseworlds better than Elseworlds did. All of the different AUs were just so much fun to watch in, like, in different ways, right? And, like, yeah, you've got, like, the sort of the chronology, which is just, like, the hilarious, that was Elseworlds with the sausage fest. And then you have Sirens of Space Time with, like, all these white blonde girls. And then Charlie stepped in to, like, be part of it, like, to infiltrate it. And I was like, okay. I like that. And, of course, I was calling it like Avenue Q or Muppets, but yeah, I mean, it's basically Sesame Street. I love the what was it, Puppets of Tomorrow, and the little song. Oh, that was so cute. And then just like the fact that Sarah wanted to keep singing. Anyway, all of the AUs were great. And I loved that there was that through line through all of them. There was Constantine, and Charlie, who were like kind of in charge of rewriting the story. So they stayed the same in terms of like their memories or whatever throughout. And then for whatever reason, because she was talking to them at the time, Zari cat just like continues throughout until the puppet happens. So I missed actual human Zari, but Zari cat was really, really cute. And I like that she was kind of the voice of reason for them, right? Like trying to get them to do the quote unquote right thing. But they were not immediately moved to do that. Like, they both have their reasons that are very powerful reasons to want to continue the way that they're going. You know, like, Constantine has his love story. He's trying to save the man that he loves, which I think is really beautiful. They did a really beautiful job with that. And then Charlie wants to bring herself back. She wants to have her powers and stay that way. I also love that they focus so much on, like, what Constantine brought to the team, right? Like, the realities are changing because of Constantine not being there, leading to certain events. But then they reveal that, like, the biggest, the most important, crucial missing link is Charlie, right? Because Charlie is the one who first made them see that fugitives are people too. Or if not literal people, they are sentient beings worthy of respect and of you bestowing your humanity on them. So I really love that, because I think that that's been probably like my biggest issue with Legends this season. And I say biggest when really, you know, Legends is wonderful. But the fact that we're seeing the Legends treat these creatures like, you know, trash, or like, you know, like killing them and actually being ruthless and lacking humanity with them. And this episode really actually faced that, you know, actually talked about it and said, like, hey, listen, if the legends don't have their empathy, they're going to become killing machines, or they're going to become monsters. Like, they will lose their humanity. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really important. Also, I love that Constantine and Dez isn't just a one-episode deal. We got more of them this week, and we get to see how far John is willing to go to save the man that he loves, to save the love of his life, or whatever that is. You know, like, their love was the make or break for the timeline. And I like that it was, like, it literally, like, you know, it kind of reminded me of Ava and Sarah, actually. Like, they had the kiss as the time is, as things are changing. Mm-hmm. So you get the, like, little, like, magical moment at the end. I really like that. And it made the twist at the end, a knife in the gut. Like, the big bad still has Desmond's body. But at the same time, that also means that there's hope for saving him, right? The big bad is Desmond, but maybe we can revert that by the end of the season so we don't have to bury our gaze, which I don't want them to do. And as Jess will mention, I like the potential that we see with Zari and Charlie. Yes. Like, I know some people were, like, concerned about it, and we've gotten a couple of nods about it. And I think I even agreed with them that, like, it's weird because there was Zari and Amaya, and, like, people shipped that, and now there's going to be Zari and Charlie. But Zari and Amaya did not have any canonical basis. Like, there wasn't an actual, like, Zari having feelings for Maya plot. And not that I'm saying that there suddenly is really a plot now, but they actually had her say that Amaya was hot, right? So now I know, like, there's a physical basis, right? Like, yes, Amaya looks good, but we're actually getting a story in terms of Charlie, you know, Charlie being her own person and Zari seeing her as her own person, first seeing her as a person, and then understanding why she is the kind of person that she is. So there's a lot of potential there that I'm excited for. Also, I like how Zari reached out to Constantine and promised that she would help with the situation with Dez. So yeah, I really love the three of them together and, like, all the potential combinations, not necessarily romantic, just of interactions that we get with the three of them. Also, I really love Mona. I love that she's just, like, the kind of person who just jumps on board and is like, hey, I want to help you guys. What's up? I'm Mona and I'm going to help you guys without asking any questions. Not, you know, she doesn't need to know anything to become part of the action. Also, Gary believing that he was talking to himself from the future was great. Just in general, I really liked all the moments of Charlie shapeshifting into people and then giving that cast member the opportunity to play Charlie, basically. So I think they're having a lot of fun with her shapeshifting abilities. And then I love the little snippet of Ava being heartbroken over Sarah and then, like, kind of springing back to life when there was a possibility of bringing her back. It was kind of like a nice little encapsulation of the usual man pain arc that you get that would take several episodes, and you got it in, like, 2 minutes. And, of course, all the callbacks to the season, to this season especially. Like, we got the unicorn, we got Fairy Godmother, we got the episode where they met Charlie. It was just, like, helped feel like this season was really well put together. And this is, like, the first time ever, I think, on Legends that I really feel like they know where they're going. Because usually we're like, oh, we don't really know what the arc is, but we don't care because we're having fun. But this is like, I see the arc. I understand what's happening. I know who the big bad is. I feel bad about the big bad. So this is all great. It's all coming together.
And it's really weird because at the beginning of the season, we're like, this is going to make no sense.
Yes! This is the season we are most concerned about.
Well, yeah, I really loved this episode as well. And I thought it was a really great finale and a really fun way to do all these different timeline changes and really, like, think big. Like, the monitor should have given the Legends writers the book because they thought big. You get, like, the A-Team AU with the Custodians of Chronology. You get a Charlie's Angels AU with the Sirens of Space-Time. You get the Sesame Street AU and I agree, like, that was probably, like, my favorite, The Puppets of Tomorrow. Because it was just, like, the most ridiculous of the ridiculous. Each AU was, like, weirder and crazier than the one before it. I feel like I prefer the Sirens of Space-Time to the Custodians of Chronology. And it's not lost on me that that acronym spells cock, so... Yeah,
it was lost on me. That's awesome.
I like, but you know, the Sirens of Space Time. You get Ava, and her code name is Roundhouse, and then Gideon is Hard Drive. I really like those. I thought those were really nice little details. And I liked how the AEs brought back the homicidal unicorn, and especially like the fairy godmother, because I really missed her, and I thought she was great. And the fact that she ran off with Rory, of all people, in one of the AEs was awesome. And Charlie, I think she had like a lot of growth. It was a really good episode for her because she could have left immediately, and she did try. But I like that when she saw what happened to the Legend's moral compass after she left, with the killing of magical creatures on site, I like that she decided that she wanted to stay, and she was committed to helping Constantine fix the timeline enough to save the magical creatures from being murdered by the Legends. So I like that her self-preservation doesn't extend just to her, but that she's also concerned about the misfits, the people that don't fit in, the people that are different from other people. So I really like that about Charlie. Cat Zari was very cute. Even if it was a shame, she was stuck in a cat form for most of the episode. I do like that Zarly is starting to, their relationship is starting to defrost a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my eyes could be deceiving me, but I feel like, you know, there's something there. It feels a little bit more like Charlie is really, even though Zari has not been welcoming to Charlie, as maybe some of the other Legends, she's like the one that's last to kind of let Charlie in. It does seem like Charlie is intrigued by Zari, and wants to, you know, get Zari to understand her. And so now that Zari is kind of starting to understand her, maybe we'll get to see some more to see if, you know, if I'm just seeing things or if there's actually something there that they want to explore. My OTP is Zari and food. I couldn't see what she was eating this time, but I'm going to say Zari and beignets because they're in New Orleans. So that was there. Zari promising to help John find Time Hack to save Desmond, and then encouraging him to do the right thing to reset the timeline. I like that she was kind of the moral, you know, the lesson giver. Like, come on, we can't half-ass this. If you want to do it, then we can find a way to do it the right way. And then Charlie being the overall MVP. I like seeing her transformation into different various forms of how she thinks the Legends act. I thought Gary from the future was her best performance. And then I like that Mona, and even in the AU timelines, is still fighting for magical creature rights. And I do like that twist at the end that Desmond, the body, is alive, and that he also connects to Hank and that storyline. So it does feel like it's all coming together. But what did we not like about this episode?
This is not a dislike, but I just realized Charlie was okay with Gary dying.
Yeah, that was so funny. And for a moment. And yes. Then she's like, no.
She's like, I guess. Yeah, I agree that human version of, or I agree with what Tati will say, that the human version of Zari wasn't in the episode as much as I'd hoped. Like, she spent too long being a cat, and I wanted more of her human form. And I guess the Legends can kill magical creatures on sight, but they wanted to give Damien Dark and all the other villains a chance. That was the one thing that threw me off, because they went from 0 to 100 really quick. And I also hated the Ava and Mick reconciliation scene. Like, you're a sexist, but you write well isn't a good reason to make up, nor does it excuse his sexism. So why do they continue to excuse his bad behavior? And it's like Ava was conceding to Mick so that he didn't have to acknowledge that he did anything wrong, which is bullshit. So if you ever want to see how men get away with saying and doing shitty things without ever having to apologize, look no further than the privilege afforded to Mick on Legends. That is all.
Thank you for coming to May's TED Talk.
Yes, I totally agree with the Mick thing. I had forgotten about that scene. I think I just imagined that it happened in the previous week. But yeah, I didn't like it either. Because, like, why point out that his female characters are, like, devoid of anything? But then be like, oh, but they're so fun to read. And I was like, ugh, okay. It just brings me back to the whole, whatever her name is, Garima thing, you know? Like, she has no agency. She has no thoughts of her own. She literally just exists as a plaything for Mick. Just like apparently his female characters do. Because she's one of them. But it's great. Because it's Mick, for whatever reason. I don't know why. But yeah, on to my other complaints. I didn't like Zari being in cat form for most of the episode, as May previewed. And then, like, she immediately switched to puppet form. you know? So, like, it made me think, like, I was like, Tala Ash must have had something going on. Like, she couldn't be in this episode much for some reason, which is fine. Like, I'm not saying, like, y'all hate Zari and you didn't write her in, because, like, obviously they love Zari. But the fact that I had to think that pulled me out of the episode momentarily, because I was like, what is the reason for this? Oh, it's because Tala Ash must be whatever. So, yeah. And I don't really have other complaints, like, except, again, I also forgot that I complained about Mona in that I don't know what happened with her at the end. Because, like, the last thing that we saw of her was she was going to die from the bleeding gash wound inflicted on her by her non-boyfriend, Kobe. and then, as far as we know, when time is restored, the Kobe does still escape from the people trying to take him, right? Because we know that Hank got that call about it. So what happened to Mona? Is she just in a gash bleeding somewhere? Is she fine? Did time go in a different way so that it never got to that point? Like, I watched twice, and I don't remember there being an answer. I don't know if I'm even supposed to ask the question. Am I supposed to?
I don't know that they wanted you to, but it should have been asked.
Like, I was just, because I was waiting, because, like, that was the thing. I was like, oh my god, Mona! And then I was like, oh good, she's alive in the new realities. And then I was like, is she dead? What's happening? Okay, anyway. But yeah, my general complaint is just that I feel like the show's a little bit crowded. Like, yes, they do a really good job of rotating and trying to give all of their characters moments to shine, but it does feel like an overwhelming amount of characters at times. Not just because it's like we have like 9 or 10 regulars now, but we also have like 3 recurring characters that don't go anywhere. Like, they're not really recurring. They're actually just also regulars who don't have a regular contract. So yeah, I feel like it's a lot of balls to juggle, and I'm concerned about them dropping them. And I wish they would drop one called Nick. But yes.
I agree with that.
I also agree with that. Yeah, I didn't like that either, that Ava and Mick found common ground, but it was because that Ava was conceding to Mick and coming halfway to him. And it's like he doesn't have to apologize, and I don't get why he just gets away with his bad behavior and never grows as a person, because it also reminds me of the fact that the time when he was paired up with Zari, and she was trying to talk about her faith, and he was just being ridiculous and rude, and that was somehow supposed to be comedy, and it just never went anywhere. Like, he didn't learn anything from her sharing her story about her faith, and in this situation he didn't learn anything about Ava saying, like, you know, you're sexist and this is wrong. So it's, you know, he just kind of gets away with stuff and doesn't grow, doesn't develop. He has no storylines other than being like a writer. And I feel like, even, you know, to have that conversation between Ava and Mick also brings up the fact that, you know, Garima is actually in this Elseworlds crossover with the Custodians of Chronology. So again, it's a little bit uncomfortable seeing her, knowing that's a plot point of contention from last week. And I just don't get what they're trying to do with that. I don't get what they're trying to do with her. That was my main issue, I think. And then the other one was just that, you know, Charlie is, I like that she's the kind of, the one that's going to stop the Legends from killing all the magical creatures, but, like, how did they even get to the point where the Legends are people that kill on sight all magical creatures? Like, what just happened to sending them back to hell where they came from? You know? It was a bit of an extreme jump, and I don't know why they went to being that ruthless. But whatever. Predictions.
You're going to save Desmond?
Do you predict that Mona is alive or dead?
I would like to think that she's alive.
She better be alive.
Yeah. And I predict that somehow, obviously, they're going to save Desmond, like, untether him, find a way to untether him from the demon. But I guess I'm also not clear on where Nate's dad stands, like,
I don't think he's going to be as evil as we might think. I think he's just wrapped up in, you know, like, being heartless with the creatures is not something that we are unfamiliar with, because the Legends are being heartless with them. So I don't think he knows he's working for, like, a demon.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be, like, a rehash of the the Minotaur episode where his dad's just going to be like an ass until Nate has to shout at him, magical creatures are people too! And then yeah. He's like, okay, let's sing.
Yeah, pretty much. So okay. I think that the real heartbreak is in Desmond, mm-hmm. you know, the Desmond duality. But I agree with you that they'll save him in the end, because otherwise, what is even the point?
What is the point?
And I also think that Mona got lost in the shuffle, so I'm sure she's alive and they won't even address the fact that she was dying.
Yeah, I think that just speaks to the show being crowded, like you said. So they're just like, oh, yeah. Mona, right.
They just forgot about her.
Yeah.
Now on to another love story that I wish they would drop, Black Lightning. The synopsis for this episode, escape. The Pierce family is reeling in the wake of Jennifer's disappearance. Jefferson, Lynn, and Anissa all gather to discuss the most effective way to find her. After learning that Jennifer is with Khalil, Lynn goes to Detective Henderson to ask him for... Did I even... This is not the right thing.
Is this from last week's?
No, it's 209. Yeah, 209 is the right one.
Okay, so this is the one from last week. So... Basically, what happens is that Jennifer and Khalil are still on the run, but Khalil is suffering from the poison from Cutter's knives, and so Jennifer has to take some risks to go to a hospital to save her deadbeat boyfriend's life. Meanwhile, Lynn is finally becoming more proactive, and instead of drinking, is trying to find ways to solve, to find her daughter on her own. And so that leads her back to Khalil's mom, Michelle, who gives her information on Khalil's dad that she goes to for information. And then Jefferson, Anissa, and Gamby try to canvass the town. But there's a little bit of contention there. And then all while that's going on, Tobias is sitting up at Club 100 trying to recruit a young man named Todd, who is somebody that's relevant. And I'm sure we'll find out more about him next year. But for now, what did we like about this episode?
Tati.
Okay. I just want to point out, I really like the animated title sequence. Like, I like them every time.
Yeah.
And I don't remember when they started happening, because I feel like they just, like, showed up one day. Two. Yeah.
They started season two. Season two. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm really liking them this season. I think that they do a good job of, like, you know, setting the scene. As much as the background music does, because the background music continues to be one of the best things about Black Lightning. I also appreciated how concerned the Pierce family was about Jennifer, and how they don't feel whole without her, and they're doing their best to find her, even without, like setting aside judgments, which is not something that they often do for her. Like, I know we're all mad at her for acting out and, like, running off with Khalil and, like, you know, for this arc in general. But I think that it is a reaction to her feeling like she's mistreated and neglected by her family all season long, right? Like, instead of helping her deal with her powers and treating her like a fully fledged member of the family, even though she's not an adult, treating her like someone who has the intelligence of one, they have been, like, leaving her out, locking her up, etc. So in their mind, they were doing it for her benefit. They are doing what they think is best for her. But obviously, it led to this, so it was not what was best for her. But I do like Lynn and Michelle bonding, like, right, over the pain they were feeling over, like, potentially losing their children, and both of them sort of, like, trying to make the other feel better, right? Like, Michelle be like, oh, I'm so sorry this happened, and your daughter's so wonderful, and blah, blah, my son sucks. He's like, no, your son is still your son, and you have to help him, and, like, whatever. And I was like, oh, you guys are so cute. I love this. I also loved Lynn taking initiative in the search for Khalil's father, and Gamby letting her, because he knew he wasn't going to talk her out of it. He's like, yeah, when she was like, I'm as stubborn as the rest of my family, so you may as well just let me do it. And he was like, all right, just, you know, I'll just watch over here. So, yeah, I like that. Also, I love RJ Seiler. The love of my life. I think he's so great. He makes everything better. So I'm looking forward to seeing what happens with him as Todd. I think he's got excellent range, so hopefully he's going to have a lot of range to pull off in this role. And I liked how Tobias's recruitment of him seemed like, it seems like a natural progression for him, right? He's like, oh, I lost one little soldier man, so let me get another one. And this time, what if I try not shooting him? And instead, just like bringing him in with like promises of money and, you know, whatever. I'm sure he's the one that like prevented Well, on the one hand, I'm like, oh, racism. That's probably the real reason why he didn't get in. But I'm also like, did Tobias just make sure he didn't get it? Because I feel like
Tobias... I feel like Tobias just made sure he did not get it.
The version of shooting him. Right. I'm not going to shoot him. I'm just going to take this grant away from him. And now I will give him my love. So, so yeah, I am interested in seeing how that dynamic plays out. And I liked Todd standing his ground, calling Tobias' bluff, even though Tobias calling Todd's bluff when Todd stood his ground. That's what I'm saying. I thought that the dynamic was much more interesting already than the beginning of the Tobias and Khalil dynamic. I loved Gamby stopping Jefferson when he was like trying to rush off to find Jennifer, even without his suit, as well as Jefferson's own desperation to find her, because it felt really realistic. Like, it seemed like everyone's in turmoil, right? The family's turned upside down. It added to the stakes of the moment, especially set against Khalil potentially dying, right? Because then at the same time, like, they don't want that to happen either. So then all it's like, oh, this will be for nothing. So. Some people want him to die. But the Pierces don't want him to die. I'm either with Jennifer. And now, like, speaking of, like, it was very kind of the Pierce family to spare a moment of worry that his life is in danger, even though he does not deserve that moment of worry. Jennifer, like, praying. And then breaking down, I thought was a really beautiful moment. China did a really good job with that, as well as the trip through her brain was very trippy. Like, it was fun to see her working out a solution with herself and with, like, kind of imaginary Perenna, and how quick she was to figure out how to find Cutter and get her to reveal the poison, as well as the antidote. Like, she has a kind of like a pragmatism to her usage of her powers that I think is not something, like, not that, you know, obviously Jefferson and Nyssa are great at being heroes, and they are very, like, they are Gryffindors, right? They just, like, jump right in and to the action and, like, save the oppressed and whatnot. And Jennifer isn't like that, but she's kind of like, she's a Ravenclaw and how she uses her powers. I don't know why I'm using these Harry Potter metaphors, but yes, that's that. I like that you see that in this episode. I also like that Khalil told her to go home. And that he seemed genuinely worried about her safety. And I wish that she had been like, you know what? Yes, I will go home. finally, I don't know what is going on with teleporting Metahuman Man. But he's sexy. And I'm interested. I like him. Can't wait to see what he does when he shows up with Freeland.
I was going to say, are we still doing that episode where we just split everyone into Hogwarts houses?
Oh, yeah.
anyway, back to Black Lightning. China's performance was really on point this episode. Like, she really brought the emotion in every single scene that she had. And I like that she took charge and went to try and steal some antibiotics for Khalil and then was able to identify Cutter in the forest, catch her, and make her tell her where she had the antidote. The scene where she's breaking down her powers and emotions in her own mind was really unique and allowed us to get in her head. So that was really cool. And I really felt Lynn's pain. And Christine Adams really delivered as well. Like, I like that she took it upon herself to get answers when she realized Jefferson and Anissa were coming up short. And I like that she turned into an investigator, bonded some more with Khalil's mom over their shared grief, and tried to find out information about his dad. I also like that Gamby didn't really tell Jefferson that she was doing that, so he was kind of being her confidant in that way, which is interesting considering their relationship before. And I also thought it was realistic that Jefferson was being emotional, losing it over his desperation to find Jennifer. And I think part of that desperation also stemmed from the disappointment he can maybe hear in Lynn's voice about not being able to find her. But I'm happy that Gamby was there to bring him back down to earth. Like, he actually took him down, which I wasn't expecting. But, like, the persistence and logic in Gamby that balanced out Jefferson's emotions. Finally, I loved RJ Seiler, and I'm really glad he got this role. And I think he did a good job going from, like, rightfully pissed off research student to suspicious of Tobias to wanting to be in on whatever plans he had. And I think Tobias did well in, like, wooing Todd. And it pulled out this, like, charming businessman side of him, which is a nice change from, like, ruthless killer version we've seen all season.
Yeah, I think that's a good... I don't know why he's doing it, but it's definitely the whole get them with honey is working for him more than what he was trying to do with Khalil. So I do like that. I like that Tati brought up the whole Jennifer being a Ravenclaw with her powers, because I think that's really accurate. And I liked... and I said this last week, if Jennifer hadn't run away with Khalil, Khalil would be dead by now, because Khalil does not know what to do. And clearly, like, Jennifer is very quick on her feet. She's very, like you said, pragmatic about the situation. And I thought that her entering her mind palace was really well done with Perinna, and, like, talking to herself and talking through things. And, like, especially how she's talking to herself about, okay, let's break this down. What did we learn in that chemistry class at one time about something about electricity? And how she used all that information to find Cutter. And then, you know, once she ambushed Cutter, this is like a world-class mercenary, but she was able to ambush Cutter, knock her out, and then figure out that there's poison in the knives and use that against Cutter to save Khalil. So all of that I thought was, like, really well done. Even her going to the hospital and figuring out how to break into the computer systems. Although I wish she would go back to her parents and her family, because they are trying to help her, so I don't understand why she's running away from them. But I do like that she's kind of surviving, that she's smart, and maybe if they had appreciated the side of her, she wouldn't have run away. I don't know. Back with the other side of the family, I like that Lynn was proactive. So I was getting worried, and I didn't like the fact that the past two episodes that she's just been kind of sitting and drinking and getting into this depressive state. So I like that this episode she actually decided to do something about it and be proactive and go and find her own clues. I liked getting to see that emotional side of Jefferson and Gammy play out. There's some other things that I don't like, but his desperation to find his daughter, and then them finally figuring out a way to work together to figure out where Jennifer could be, was really good. Like the needle in a haystack scene. And then back to Todd. It's kind of weird because it's, I don't know, it's like a weird detail within the scene, but the fact that when Tobias is trying to woo Todd, and he's, like, wooing him with, like, women, he's like, do you like what you see? And Todd was like, I just prefer, like, them not touch me. I thought was an interesting detail and kind of, like, insight to his character. And I wonder if that's just because he's uncomfortable, or if they were actually trying to say something, going to say something about his, like, sexuality and how he sees himself and how he sees other people. Because I think he also thought it was, like, disrespectful for Tobias to, like, push women onto him, for the women. And then the last scene, we don't know who this new teleportation dude is. And I'm wondering, well, I'll put that in predictions. But I like seeing him, and we'll see whether he's a good guy or a bad guy, hopefully when we come back. But what did we not like about this episode?
I did not like Jennifer running into her family at the hospital and then, like, not even having a second hesitation before she ran off. Like, there wasn't – I didn't get the sense that she, like, misses them or, like, wants to be reunited with them. And I feel like I should. Like, I feel like China could play it really well, and it would be easy to incorporate the duality of, like, wanting to be with your family but also feeling like they won't understand, even though they will. But I don't think that the writing really left room for it. It was just kind of like she's, like, very one-track mind right now, which I guess is fine because Khalil's life is in danger, but I think that there's room, or there should be room for her to, you know, care about her family too. Tobias's need for Khalil to be alive feels, like, random. Like, I know he, like, has a need for total control of things, and, like, so he's like, I want to be the one that kills him, but it's, like, inefficient because it's, like, you know, he could just be dead and then you wouldn't have a problem, like, done. But it sort of feels like it's one of the many things that make this arc specifically, but the way the season has been going overall, to be, like, too much about Khalil. Like, it's Khalil's story and then Jennifer is a love interest, and then the Pierce family is just, like, also here. So I feel like I don't really understand where this came from. It's just, like, a lot of focus on Khalil's man pain, and then the fact the show wants us to ignore how the dynamic with Jennifer started off. Like, they're the ones that made Khalil act like a little shit before Tobias involved himself. Like, yes, Tobias is the one that had him shot, but, like, Khalil was the one who lashed out at her and who made her feel like garbage and who dumped her because he couldn't walk. You know, like that, Tobias didn't make that happen. And now they just kind of want to make it seem like, oh, look at this adorable Bonnie and Clyde ride or die situation. You could get away with that if you hadn't written it the way you did in season one. But you did. So it's just annoying that they don't want me to remember that. And then Christine Adams kills it every week with her performance. But, like, I just want Lynn to stop being in pain. Like, why? Her crying because she thought that Jennifer was dead. I was so sad. I was like, why? Why? Make it stop. No one else. Jennifer's not dead. Anyway, I just want her to be happy. So that's so just like, back to Jennifer, though. I don't like that she has to be ride or die over, like, a two-week-old relationship at 16 years of age. Like, I know that your emotions run high when you're 16 or whatever, but given that Jennifer is so smart and she is so pragmatic, I don't know why she wouldn't take a second to find out if her family would help them when push comes to shove, you know? Like, I think that she's smart enough to, like, emotionally blackmail her family into taking Khalil in. You know, like, there's no reason why they wouldn't be like, the options are Jennifer disappears forever with this dude, or we bring Jennifer and this dude in and promise to keep him safe from Tobias and not, like, I don't know, make them sleep in separate rooms and not talk to each other for a year or whatever, you know? Like, I don't know. It just seems really weird that it just seems like a forced separation to create all this angst when in reality Jefferson would, and Lynn would just be like, all right, fine, you guys come, but no hanky-panky. The end.
No hanky-panky, yes. Jennifer told Khalil she loved him, and that's when I really stopped taking this episode seriously. Like, you barely even dated. Maybe it was his near-death experience, and I can understand that, but I still continue to dislike how they're painting this supposed love story. Like, it's getting too much focus, and for what? We know Jennifer is going to end up going back home. It's just a matter of when. And as was already mentioned, they're making Jen's story about Khalil, and I hate to think that she cares more about him than going back to her family for help when that makes the most sense at this point. Like, she knows her dad and sister are superheroes, so her actions look even more irresponsible. And then Lynn desperately needs some love and validation. I agree. I can't take the fact that she's constantly being left alone to her grief and anguish with no hope of coming out of it, because that's really depressing. And then, to be honest, I wasn't really feeling this episode as a mid-season finale. I feel like it was another episode of Jennifer and Khalil on the run and an introduction to new characters, but with absolutely no focus on any of the plot threads that have been laid out before. So I'm starting to wonder if Black Lightning has a pacing issue because they're bringing in too many new people with no real forward movement. And I'm going to start a Grace sighting every podcast, because this episode marks two episodes in a row that we haven't seen her. So the writers have once again dropped her and her storyline for no good reason. And this time it's so they can focus on a more toxic relationship. And I'm really tired.
Mm-hmm. You're tired.
Jessica's the most tired of us.
I am the most tired of the storyline. Oh my god. And it just keeps, like, honing in on the things that we were talking about, you know, last week, with Khalil displays abusive behavior in the past, and Jennifer is written as some kind of, like, right, and she says she's ride or die. So, like, the whole kind of stereotype or negative assumption within the Black community that the Black woman has to be ride or die for her man, no matter how much of a trash bag the man is or how much shit he is and how much he's not doing anything bettering her life, that, oh, you have to just pick him up and you have to be there for him. That's not something that I want to be looked up to and see in media. That's something that I want to be, or see, like, a lesson that I have to do that. And so, like you said, like, she's a smart girl. We've seen that she is so smart with how she uses her powers and how she thinks through things with herself. So why is this, like, this one thing that, you know, she doesn't want to go to her parents or to her family. And so, like, it doesn't really make sense with why Cutter and Tobias are after us does not trump, I'm going to get in trouble because I ran away, or something like that. So I continue to not understand why it's not even a thought or an issue. You know, clearly they're still out here looking for you. They want to find you because they love you. So why won't you let them love you? I don't understand that. And the fact that they are submitting this as a Bonnie and Clyde love story with the exchange of the L words, this is just a toxic relationship, and it's not good writing. And why are they spending so much time on Kennifer when you have a ready-made ship in Thundergrace that everyone was on board, and they have none of this energy for Thundergrace at all. So it's just kind of frustrating on all accounts that you're spending so much time developing this toxic relationship and trying to sell it to us as romantic. Like Anissa's whole season one storyline with her powers was her developing them herself, her figuring out them by herself, and slowly working them back into the story. Jennifer's whole season two storyline of developing her powers has to do with Khalil. Like, she can only use her powers and know how to use them and control them when she's got to save Khalil. So why is, like, you know, her entire storyline is focused on Khalil instead of focused on herself? Even, like, the hang-up with, you know, her freaking out and using her powers or like, overcharging or whatever. In the Mind Palace with Perrina, it boiled down to you're thinking about a boy. You're thinking about Khalil. So everything is about Khalil. Everything, like, goes back to Khalil, and it's, where is Jennifer and all of that? Nowhere. So all of that is just hot, hot garbage. And we know she gets a suit, so obviously she comes home at some point, but I don't even see how they get back to that from where they ended off on the mid-season finale. And then the other thing that I kind of really didn't like, or I'm not sure where this season is trying to go, but Jefferson and Anissa's just whole relationship. And I don't know if it's because Jennifer is not there that the Pierce family is such a mess, because I don't like Lynn's depressive state either, but mm-hmm. also Jennifer and Anissa just seem to be kind of like spiraling away from each other, and that's really kind of concerning to me. And I don't really know why or what the Black Lightning writers think that they're doing with this season. So, yeah, I feel less invested than I was the previous season, which is weird. Predictions.
I predict that Todd will become either Hardware or Technocrat, who are both heroes. So, I mean, Hardware is a criminal who realized how bad his employers were and then turned his technology on them instead, and then became a hero. And then Taylor Rat's just a regular ass hero. Like, I think he's an outsider. So I think that regardless, Tobias's plan will backfire, and he will just keep creating more enemies that are heroes. Also, teleporting dude. I know Jessica was talking about the possibility of him being an outsider when we were discussing previously. So maybe she has ideas on who he could be. The only one that I saw that I thought he could be is Bolt, who is a special effects artist and assassin who designed a special suit that gives him the power to teleport and also protect energy blasts.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. And those are my predictions.
I predicted while I was watching the episode that Khalil would actually die and that, like, RJ Seiler's character would just take his place in general. But I was wrong.
You were just so,
yeah. I have no predictions moving forward because I really don't know where this show is going.
Well, I thought that, you know, the teleporting guy could be an outsider. It's interesting that you say that. Is it Technocrat that's the outsider?
Yes.
So they have Technocrat. They introduced Dr. Jace. They introduced Looker. And, you know, Todd is possibly going to become Technocrat. And then one that I missed, and we brought it up, but it just completely went over my mind, but the Markovia mention.
Yeah,
so what is his name? Guy Force? What's the hero name? Because it's like Tara's brother, right?
Yes.
What's his name?
Tell me your name.
Geoforce.
Oh, yes, Geoforce, okay. Yeah.
I'm like, I know it starts with a G.
Brian Markoff, yes.
Yes. So clearly, that's the only thing that seems clear is that they're trying to build something for the outsiders. So I don't really know who teleporting dude might be, but that was why I was kind of thinking that maybe he is an outsider, either a hero or a villain. So that's my only prediction for that one. And then finally, we move into Titans, the episode called Coriander that is not about Coriander. As Cori's memories come flooding back, she discovers her mission has never been to protect Rachel, but something much more dangerous. Struggling to understand why, Dick and Donna are shocked to discover that Cori is an alien who reveals Rachel's frightening origins. But most of the story is about Rachel and her mother Angela and the creepy fucked up house in wherever the fuck Ohio that Angela lives, and the identity of Rachel's father, and how dangerous he can be, and how Angela is not the woman that she appeared to be initially. Trigon's here, y'all. What do we like about this episode?
I mean, I thought Trigon was super creepy when he was introduced. I did think that the whole house situation felt like a true horror movie, like the hanging tire on the tree and the creepy sheriff showing up in the middle of nowhere. Like, it was just very, very horror-esque. Like, you knew some shit was about to go down in this house. And I liked that. I mean, even though some of this will go into my frustrations as well, that Gar was, like, the focus of Rachel's, like, part of her emotional story. And that her dad knew that if, and her mom, like, if they got to him, then they would get to her and all that. I did enjoy that at least Dick and Rachel defended Cori and knew that she wasn't being herself because they know that she loves Rachel and would defend her. So like that little choking thing was just had to be something else. So I like that they at least recognize that. Yeah. I mean, I really disliked a lot of stuff more than
okay. You're like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I see that y'all wrote like two sentences each.
Well, I didn't get to finish. I didn't get to finish my notes because I was like, let me start with my dislike.
So, are you finished now?
Yes, you may go.
Okay. I will say that I liked the atmospheric horror of the episode. Like, I thought that they did a good job establishing the like haunting of Hill House-ness of the supposed safe house and how it used the character's fears against them. So, like, we thought that Cori was trying to kill Rachel because her memories had sprung to the surface, right? But really, or at least what I understood was that it was the house that's sort of, like, playing off of her unconscious knowledge that Rachel could kill her people, and thus it's acting out on her behalf when Cori herself doesn't actually feel that way. Even at once she learns the truth, she's not actually like, I guess I gotta go kill Rachel. You know, like, that's not... That's not a natural sentiment coming from her. And similarly, Rachel is afraid of the darkness inside of her, right? And so then that darkness lashes out at Gar, who is the very person that she's trying to protect from said darkness. And then Gar is haunted by that dude that he had to kill, and so he literally is haunted by that dude and his gross, bloody body. So all of that was really, like, well done, I thought. I also liked how Rachel and Dick, neither of them wavered in their belief that something else was affecting Cori, right? The whole time they were like, no, Cori loves Rachel. She would never do this. She's a good person. They were not fooled into thinking like, oh, I guess Cori sucks. unlike some people. Although those people were not fooled. Those people were just Angela, who sucks, and then Donna, who doesn't know anything. Okay. But I liked the Star Wars-esque holograms in Cori's spaceship. I definitely was like, Obi-Wan, you're my only hope, the entire scene. And I wish that we'd gotten to see more of that, right? Actually got to, like, play with all the stuff on Cori's ship. But I also liked, I liked, like, the the way the old book looked and the drawings on it. And Corey, you know, again, like playing on that, she innately understands what she's seeing, even though she doesn't actually remember it. So yeah, I also, I liked, or I didn't like this, but it was smart of Angela slash Trigon, the house, whatever, to put Gar's life on the line so that Rachel would call up her dad and then accept his help because she would do anything to help, you know, her friends. So I was upset by it, but I was like, oh, well done, bad guys. You know what you're doing. It also reflects how much Rachel, like, relies on the people around her, relies on the people that she cares about, right? Like, she puts so much emotional investment in them because, I guess, she's afraid of putting it in herself. I don't know. Anyway, I do have to ask, though, this isn't a like, but now I'm just asking, like, I was like, why? She talked about how not being able to read Corey's mind, but, like, why didn't she ever read her feelings? But, like, why didn't she ever try to read her mom's feelings? Because that would have solved a lot of problems if you had done that from the start. Like, I'm going to check on my mom. Like, she's been trapped in this place for 5 years. Maybe I should check and see if she's doing okay. Oh, what's that you say? She feels deep and abiding love for my creepy-ass father, who is the reason Aaron wants to kill me? Should check that out. But anyway.
that would have ended the season a lot quicker if she did that in the first place. I do agree with you that I didn't like it. I didn't like seeing Gar having pain physically inflicted on him, and that'll be like a big part of the dislikes. But I do agree with you that narratively it was smart, one, for Angela to separate Corey and by having her leave the house, but also keeping Gar there and using Rachel's love for Gar against her to kind of bring out the darkness in her father. I thought that was all smartly done, even though I did not like Angela at all. I also like how both Dick and Rachel were very protective of Corey and knew that it wasn't the real her. Like, Dick defended Corey to Donna and was like, you know, she's not a killer. She just kills people sometimes. She's not a killer. And I like that Rachel, like the little emotional being that she is, puts the outburst. Of course, she's like a little bit, you know, scared and hesitant at first because, you know, something could still go wrong. But I like that as she's thinking about it, she's thinking that she broke Corey. Obviously, something she did was wrong because Corey would never do that to her. And she knows that. And so she knows that there's a separation. She wrongly believes it is her fault. But I like that she doesn't blame Corey for what happened. And then I agree with you that, like, the special effects of the haunted house and the whole aesthetics of the haunted house and the creepiness of it were well done. What did we not like?
I was really excited that this episode was called Coriander. Then I watched 42 minutes of bullshit because none of it was really about her at all. And then Jess pointed out on Twitter who the writer was. And I wasn't surprised because it's the same showrunner who sidelined Iris in all of 2A. Anyway, I really hated the fact that we get zero backstory on Corey. So no flashbacks, no concrete memories. She was used for exposition about Rachel and her dad, which was frustrating because, one, that information is coming too late in the season anyway. And two, why are we not dedicating any time to one of the main characters of the show? Like, if we can watch Dick brood over Batman for 10 episodes and die of boredom watching Hank and Dove do whatever, then there's no excuse that an episode actually named after her shouldn't be focused solely on her. Like, who are Corey's parents? What was her life like? They make it seem like her mission was her sole purpose in life, and that's really ugly. And it's also disrespectful and says that they think white characters, even if they're not even regulars, are far more important, especially when they get several episodes to dig into who they are as people and their issues. So this episode was especially let down given that they interrupted the pacing and cliffhanger from 2 episodes ago to give us Hank and Dove 2.0. And then when we finally get back to the main story, they completely sidelined Corey in it and made it about Rachel and her dad. So the bullshit was very strong this week over the course of all the shows. I dislike the fact that Donna's being held to such high standards as well, as if like her goodness is why Dick should be with her. And it made Corey look like a bad decision on Dick's part, which is false. And I can understand if maybe Donna was being protective, but the fact that the writers actually wanted to draw that comparison is annoying. So we as the audience know Corey better, but the story is making it seem like Dawn was the one that got away, even though that makes no sense with last week's episode. So did Dawn cheat on Hank with Dick? Where does this fit into the story? Because I don't care about the relationship and it's unnecessary to begin with.
And then if she cheated, then that's not that good.
Right. So, like, give Corey her due and stop shitting on her character and using her to prop up white characters. Thanks. And I agree the same goes with for Gar. Like, he's only been used as support for Rachel and what she's going through, but didn't have an entire episode dedicated to him either. So he doesn't even have a memory problem, but the writers don't seem concerned that he's gotten little development. And finally, the sheriff storyline was, like, a misdirect, yes, but it also didn't need to be there because it wasted minutes that could have gone to Corey, and it was also unnecessary.
I agree with everything that you have said. but yeah, I don't think it's cute that we are 10 episodes into a 12-episode season and Corey's backstory has lagged so far behind all of her white counterparts, including glorified guest stars who have appeared in 3 episodes or less. And this is also true of Gar, but this episode was literally called Coriander. So one would think that it was finally her time to shine. And instead, we got, like, 2 scenes about her people and her planet and her backstory, but none of it was about her. It was literally just like, Rachel means this for my people, and I'm supposed to stop Rachel. And so all of the things that I'm saying are about Rachel. And it's all about how, you know, my people that we don't even know, we didn't learn anything about them. Like, we don't know what Tamarins look like. Do they look like Corey? Or is that her human disguise? Is it an actual alien thing that Tamarins look like? Where is Tamarin? How long have they been around? Who is her family? Anyway, no, we don't know any of these. We only know Rachel things. And this is not to say that I have something against Rachel, because I love Rachel, and Rachel's probably my favorite character, because there aren't very many options, because they don't develop Corey and Gar very well. So, but I really resent the discrepancy, because, like, the entire season has been about saving Rachel's soul and the universe at once from her father. So I totally understand why she's getting that much development. But it does not stop Dick from getting 300 flashbacks and moments of self-reflection in every episode. So it's not like Rachel is taking anything away from Corey. They have all the time in the world to spend on Dick and on, like, people, like, tertially adjacent to his backstory that then they can spend a whole episode being like, what are Hank and Dodd up to? And how does their relationship somehow minimally affect Dick's life? And, oh, here's Jason. And let's compare Jason's relationship with Bruce to Dick's relationship with Bruce, even though we haven't even met Bruce. And this is not moving the story forward at all. So they have all the time in the world to do all of this. But they don't have even half of one episode to spend on Corey. And, you know, in the past, they didn't have more than 2 scenes of one episode to spend on Gar, because they had to spend the whole episode on Doom Patrol, who we never saw again. Anyway, so I don't understand the pacing of the show at all. Like, I don't understand why they've... It's like world building, but the world's not connecting. So I guess it's going to kind of connect in this weirdo dream sequence that we'll talk about that, you know, in predictions. Like, maybe that's when it's going to connect. But somehow I have a feeling that it's not gonna feel earned or worth it. Anyway, I also don't like the way that sort of Gar's, like, main personality trait is to be, like, Rachel's, like, loyal guard tiger who suffers the slings and arrows of cruel fate so that Rachel can be okay. Like, based on what? His deep and abiding love for her, but why? I love it, but I don't understand it. I also did not like Donna belittling, you know, whatever Dick and Corey have. And I say whatever, because most of it has been off screen, which is another part of the issue. So you've got Donna coming in to be like, oh, Corey's just another one of those dangerous women that you're into. Unlike Dawn, but you let, at first I didn't understand what that meant. First I was like, you're into dangerous women, but you weren't into Dawn because you fucked that up. So I was like, Dawn is dangerous? And I was like, no, you're into dangerous women. And then Dawn, whom you fucked up. But either way, I don't like either version of that sentence. So it's just all bad. It's like, why are we separating Dawn? Like, why is Dawn the one you're separating? Yeah. That's not how it's supposed to be.
Why are you bringing her up?
Yeah. Like, if you're writing a story about that, you're including a couple because I can't even say you're writing a story about a couple, that's not the case, but you're writing a story that includes a couple, and that couple is Dick and Corey, then you're supposed to have the character comes in and be like, you're different with her, you know? Like, I can tell you're sleeping with her because you're being different about her. Not, I can tell you're sleeping with her because you're doing exactly the same thing you do all the time, except for Dawn, which was different. That is wrong. You did it wrong. I don't know. I think it's really weird that we've gotten more development for Rachel and Gar's, like, eighth grade, do you like me, check yes or no romance, than we have on, like, a full-fledged relationship between two grown adults who are having sex multiple times and who would like to start it all over again once they've found themselves. Like, how have we had, like, three conversations relating to that all season? I don't know, but it's stupid. Finally, the Angela thing, like, the twist with Angela was so obvious from the get-go, right? It was, like, it was way too easy to rescue her. Obviously, something's wrong. She must be brainwashed or working for Trigon or whatever. So I wasn't even surprised in this episode. And instead, it just felt like a lot of time wasted to get us to the, like, oh, psych, you know? Angela's evil. And I was like, yes, thank you. I knew that. And thus, all this time wasted with Tommy, too. Like, what is the point of Tommy? Just to prove that she's, like, a batshit crazy person who's going to kill this rando that she knew before? Like, I know it was, like, a misdirect, because at first you're like, oh, is Tommy going to, I don't know, take Rachel in, or is Tommy going to take Corey in, or whatever? But, like, no, he's not. And it was obviously going to be a twist so that she could take Rachel in instead. So, whatever. It felt bad. I didn't like it. It's all screen time that should have gone to Corey. Yeah, the fact, I don't know. I just don't understand. How are you going to have fucking, like, the princess of Tamaran, who comes to Earth with, like, an important mission, and then not show that mission? Do you not have money for the budget? Like, can't you just draw stick figures of her past and have it acted out like shadows in the cave? Yes. Allegory of Tamaran. I don't care. I don't care if you had to do, like, a fucking info dump of, like, Corey just giving, like, a 5-minute monologue where she's like, well, first I was born, and then I did this, and then just, like, cut to, like, people's faces reacting to the things she's saying because you didn't have money to create Tamaran, but you should do something for her backstory.
If they didn't have money to create Tamaran, maybe they shouldn't have spent a whole fucking episode on Dawn and Hank in the middle of their season. Yeah, like, start there. Let's start there. Like, yeah. Let's not do that. That one episode, it's not enough that that one episode just interrupted the entire season in the cliffhanger of the actual story. It's the fact that we did that, and then when we get to an episode that's supposed to be about one of the core characters, it's not even about her. Like, I would be surprised if Corey got more than 8 minutes in her own episode that's titled after her. I went on Twitter because I was annoyed that not only was the episode wasn't about her, it was more about, like, Rachel, and you have all this, that's another thing, because, like, Rachel's plot has been going on since the beginning of the fucking season. Y'all have been wasting all this time trying to find her dad and try to keep her away from her dad, and then as soon as it's Corey's time to shine, all of a sudden we have to deal with shit about Rachel and her dad. Like, why are you choosing now to pull this trigger on this storyline when you could have set up the whole thing with Corey and then have that happen, like, take out Dawn and Hank, and put in Coriander, and then put in Trigon, and then do whatever the fuck you plan on doing for Batman versus Robin and Sally, because you know it's the only thing that people care about in the first place. And, like, the whole Dawn and Hank episode is flashbacks, and the one time that flashbacks would actually be fucking useful, we don't get them. We get Corey trying to, like, speed read through, like, however long worth of memories, because at that moment, she needed to provide exposition for what was going on back at the house. So, like, all season, Corey knows none of the things, and as soon as Rachel's plot needs Corey to know some of the things, she suddenly knows all of the things. And so it just doesn't, and then she doesn't even get to be the hero in her own fucking story, because as soon as they go back to the house, like, she can't, okay, back up to the beginning of the episode when, you know, she has, like, the overcharge and is trying to kill Rachel, and Donna has to subdue her with the lasso of truth. And then Angela goes all 53% on her. It's like, no, you have to get out of my house now. And, like, this is kind of, like, they know her. Like, I feel like Angela knows her enough to know that this isn't normal. Or that she, like, if Rachel can figure out that what happened here was an accident, and they can figure out what happened here was an accident. I just, it feels like an even more of a slap in the face that she's kind of ostracized. Like, her episode is about her being kicked out of the group for something that she can't control. And so at the end of the episode, she still doesn't even get to fix it or make it right with Rachel and Gar, because whatever Shimmer thing is protecting the house, the haunted house, won't let her in. Dick is a special snowflake, so he gets to go in the house because he's the one that's most important to Rachel. So somehow, this episode about Coriander is not about Coriander. It's about Rachel, but it's also about Dick. Again. And meanwhile, Gar is getting pain inflicted upon him, and he doesn't even get to say anything. He's never had any kind of opportunity to talk about anything related to him outside of one conversation that he has with Corey about killing the guy. But just him being used, like you said, as the protective tiger, only to be like, you know, take all the slings and arrows to protect Rachel, is just kind of ridiculous at this point. And it's frustrating that these are the only two minority characters, and they just get treated like shit in this one episode, no less.
Yeah,
there's all this time wasted on Tommy. Like, as soon as it cut over to Corey in the car, like, finally, and then that was all it was just one scene with her in the car. Because we have to waste time with Angela, you know, fake flirting with Tommy for whatever reason, because she's secretly evil. I talked about the whole Donna, Don, Dick thing on Twitter as well. And it's not even, I don't have an issue. It's not a ship thing. I don't have an issue with Don. I don't have an issue with Donna. I get Don as a person. I get Donna being the protective big sister. What I don't get is why it was necessary to bring that up in this episode. That is, not only, like, is she getting Corey being used to prop Rachel's story within her own episode, but Dawn is also being propped up over Corey within her own episode. So it's like two white women being propped up over Corey in an episode that's supposed to be about Corey. And that's, it's just, like, ridiculous at this point. And then we can even go into the predictions now, because this kind of just flows into my frustration about it, because the whole thing, I think that when Dick went into the house, he's going to wake up in some kind of AU, and it's to be determined whether he knows he's in that AU or not. But in that world, I think that it's going to be portrayed as the world that the life that he was supposed to have, quote unquote. And he is with Dawn in that world. And Jason comes and is like, you know, Gotham's a mess, Batman's a mess, you have to go. And that Corey is going to be representative of the other love of Dick's life that he also forgot about, which is his job, because she's a detective, I think, within Gotham. And so, like, that whole, but how do you even get there? Like, looking at the promos, like, how did you even get there from where this episode ended? Like, it just doesn't really make any sense. And the fact that Dawn and Dick are together in this AU, because that's what his life was supposed to be, because she's the one that got away, and this is what his happily ever after should have been. It's just, like, a whole bunch of, like, bullshit, and I'm not here for it. The end. What all do you have to say, other ladies?
Well said. Next episode is the finale, so I'm annoyed. I'm just annoyed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my prediction, that I'll be annoyed.
I agree with you. It's going to be an alternate reality or a dream or whatever that's orchestrated by Trigon. That happens when, you know, what's his face, Dick crosses the threshold into the other side. And, like, unless Corey is, like, you know, wins him over in the AU, right? Like, then he's like, oh, wait a second, I thought this was cool, fighting Batman and being married to Dawn, but then I saw this chick, and I was like, wait a second, this isn't that cool. I gotta change it.
You know it's going to be Rachel. You know it's going to be Rachel, because true love wins all, and, like, he's the father that she should have had. Yeah.
It's going to be the battle of Rachel's dads, right? Her bio dad versus her real dad.
And both of them suck, because both Trigon sucks. And then Dick has abandoned her, like, three different times already, whereas right? Yes. Like, Corey has been there for the entire time and doesn't even probably get to take part in this whole finale of saving Rachel's soul. So, just whatever.
Yeah, so it's going to be whatever. It's going to be stupid. But I forgot to mention this, but, like, as much as I like Dick being like, oh, I have to go after Corey, that's really nice. But also, like, parents can't leave the kids home alone because this is what happens. So I was because you left Rachel and Gar to fend for themselves.
They thought they had a responsible babysitter.
They definitely, you don't pick up a babysitter who's been traumatized for the last 5 years in some weird mental asylum. Yeah, and then put in charge of your demon baby and your tiger son. it's fine. So yes, those are my predictions.
Ladies with gumption nominations for side B.
Charlie!
Yes, Charlie.
Yay!
Charlie again! Yeah, she's, you know, controlling that. She's writing the timelines, and she's humanizing the legends, and she's, you know, becoming more selfless on her own, and yeah, she's saving the magical creatures. She's really doing it all.
Sounds good. So I think, like, instead of doing, like, one overall one, I think we can leave, because Elseworlds is, like, a whole other thing. So I think we can have, like, Kara be the Lady with the Gumption of Elseworlds, and then the Lady with Gumption for the rest of the week will be just Charlie.
I agree. We can have dual one. Charlie is Lady with Gumption, and Kara is Lady of Elseworlds.
Lady of the Crosser. Yeah.
That was it for this week. This is the winter finale for most of the shows. We still have this bullshit finale for Titans next week.
Yeah, we'll have that. Spend 2 hours on the garbage that is Titans finale.
Yes. So that'll pick up next week, and then we'll try and get through some of our winter hiatus topics. So stay tuned for that. See you next week.
Bye.